That's the way the Swiss clear their throat. Good afternoon, and welcome to our panel on sustainable mobility, otherwise known as cars and fuels of the future. Are we there yet? If you're American, you know why I put, are you there yet? The path to sustainable mobility. I just wanted to make two small announcements. One is I apologize for the registration. There were some mix-ups with people registering. We wanted to make sure everyone's name that we actually had on our list had a seat. We, of course, always have more people registered than eventually show up, but we did need to observe the people who had registered. Our panel today will be in two parts. There is a break, and there will be coffee outside the door at the break and some water. If you are a journalist and you would like some information, additional information on the panelists, you can contact myself and also our media consultant, Kathleen Bertolani, who's probably just standing outside, and we're happy to help you. When you ask a question, we just ask that you identify yourself, who you're affiliated with, if there's an affiliation, et cetera. And I think now I will turn the stage over to our moderator. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much, Amy, and welcome everyone to the first day of the World Environment Day. It's actually a several-day conference sponsored by the United Nations, and on behalf of the mayor of San Francisco and the governor of California, welcome. Can I just get a show of hands? How many of you are not from the San Francisco Bay Area? So more than, say, 50 miles away. Okay, great. So we've got about a third. Okay, well, a special welcome to those of you who came from far away. My name is Larry McGid, and I'm the moderator of the panel today. I'm the non-technical person here, so one of my jobs, in addition to keeping the time and keeping us on track, is to make sure that we are connecting with you. And I've got a few different tools to do that. One thing I want to mention is that I've just handed out some of these question forms. There are some more in the back on a table. If at any point today you have a question that you would like to ask the panelists, please just fill out this form, pass it to the aisle. We'll collect it. There's going to be two separate question and answer periods, one at the end of our first discussion, and then the second one will be at the end of our second discussion after the break. And again, the way we're breaking up, the way we've broken up the panels, part one is cars and people, and we have three panelists, and part two is the path to alternate fuels. Before I introduce the first panelists, let me just briefly set the stage, and obviously this was one of the most popular events. You all are very fortunate. There are many people who wanted to be here who were not able to register for this event. We have some of the world's leading experts on alternative fuels and what's going to be coming in the next decade and beyond. But just to set the stage, obviously there are several major forces going on globally right now that are affecting our environment, that are affecting transportation. The major ones that come to mind immediately for me are obviously population growth, huge explosion in economic activity in some of the most populated parts of the world, in particular China and India, and a very large increase in the demand for and consumption of energy, in particular energy as a transportation fuel. And in that realm, transportation, fossil fuels have dominated. They dominated the 20th century, and they certainly are continuing to dominate today, but it's not clear how much longer we're going to be able to use fossil fuels, or that how long we will be able to sustain that use of fossil fuels. And there are major questions for policymakers about infrastructure, major questions obviously about the environment, about security, and certainly about technology. And all of those are going to be touched on in the presentations that you're going to hear this afternoon. So without further ado, let me introduce our first panel. Leading off, and also let me just take a quick moment to thank the sponsors of this event. Today's program is organized by the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, which, for those in the know, is ETH, and that is in Zurich. and also the Paul Scherrer Institute, PSI, in association with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the University of California at Davis Institute of Transportation Studies, and Chevron Texaco. And I also want to make a special thanks, I don't know if she can hear me now, but Amy Ambrose has been working very hard for the last couple months to put this together. So thank you, Amy, if you're in earshot. Let me now introduce our first panel. Leading off is going to be Chris Onder from Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. Chris is a senior lecturer at ETH, and he is a research associate and senior lecturer where he coordinates all of the engine system activities of the Measurement and Control Laboratory. The Measurement and Control Laboratory has numerous research contracts with car manufacturers and suppliers, and he's going to be talking about one of the hottest projects. Just 10 days ago, he and his team won the pack with their pack car, won the world's most, I guess, how do you describe the competition? He's going to explain this. This is phenomenal, but they went thousands of kilometers on the equivalent of 1 liter of gasoline. So it's just phenomenal. Then next will be Philip Dietrich. Philip is the head of technology transfer at the Paul Scherrer Institute in Switzerland. And Philip's major research involves the modeling and assessment of energy systems for mobility and the development of an application of energy conversion. And then finally, the first panel will be the last speaker for the first panel will be Dan Sperling, and Dan is the director of the University of California at Davis Institute of Transportation Studies, and Dan has been a leader in the transportation policy community as well as in the engineering community, and I could go on, but he is one of the most active academics in the transportation field in all of the different academies and has authored something like 160 technical papers and 8 books since his academic career began just over 20 years ago. So without any further delay, let me turn it over to Chris. And again, we will have at the end of this panel 10 or 15 minutes for Q&A. And if you have one of these, fill it out. If you don't, there's a few more in the back. We'll be collecting them just before the Q&A. Then we'll have a coffee break. We'll come back, and we will have the second panel. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Larry. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure for me to tell you this afternoon something about our PACCAR project at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. My name is Chris Onder, as it's indicated. What is the PACCAR project? We started about 3 years ago with the PACCAR project because we had several interesting projects with fuel cells, and we wanted to try a fuel cell in a fuel efficiency competition vehicle car. So PACCAR is really a car built for a fuel efficiency competition, and the competition takes place in Europe in 4 different countries each year. So when we started, we first took an existing car. We only placed a fuel cell in that car. We made 1,700 kilometers per liter of gasoline equivalent, of course, because fuel cell drives with hydrogen. And then we said, okay, the world record at that time was about 3,000 kilometers per liter. We want to go for the world record and we want to win that competition. So 2 years ago, we organized with 4 students of our department a so-called project-oriented major. So the students do not take lectures, make exams, et cetera, et cetera. So they really take the lectures that help them solving the problems of their project. So they took the lectures which helped them making PACCAR. Now let's see if that works. Now here. So the goal was clearly winning Shell Eco Marathon in Nogaro, France, May 21st. You realize that's 1.5 weeks ago. We were winning there. And we also wanted to set a new world record for fuel economy. And Shell told us we had the new world record in fuel economy. So 2 goals are achieved. But of course, story goes on. In 1 month, there will be a second attempt in Rockingham in England, where we want to set the world record even further on, because that track is a little bit more favorable. So the team, as I already mentioned, 4 students of our department. Of course, they had a lot of support, 4 seniors of our measurement and control lab. We were looking for drivers. We wanted to have students as drivers. So we were advertising, and we found 2 ladies who are willing to drive PACCAR to participate in that project, and took the risk that at the end, everybody points at her and says, "Hey, you failed." But they did not. We got large support from the workshop at IMRT and the workshop at ETH. We had support from University of Valenciennes, where actually PACCAR 1 came from PSI. Philipp Dietrich belongs to PSI, and other companies in Switzerland, and of course many, many other people. So roughly 5,200 people were really involved in the project. But the main tasks were these 4 project-oriented major students. We had 2 main sponsors, which is the Swiss Energy Agency and ETH itself, and I really want to thank them very much for their money, which made it possible to make a PACCAR. There is a small leaflet outside with the homepage is indicated, so if you are interested to get more information on PACCAR, please take such a leaflet. Now going to the details. If you want to make a competition car, you really have to optimize everything. So you have to take into account all the forces acting on the vehicle. So aerodynamic force is dependent on the square of the speed, of the frontal area, etc., etc., etc. And you have to really optimize every point you see here. You also have to optimize how the driver is driving. So we were optimizing the driving strategy. The driver had a plan when to accelerate, when to drive at constant speed, when to glide, really to make everything optimal. Once again, what is the Scheleco Marathon exactly? Of course, we cannot drive 4,000 kilometers with an average speed of 30 kilometers just like that. It would take much too long time. So we are driving 25 kilometers within 50 minutes. And these are hard limits. So we have to have that average speed to be at the end of the 25 kilometers after 50 minutes. And the only criteria is to drive with as less fuel as possible. And the fuels, that's the last point here, are weighted according to their lower heating value, so you can compare gasoline to diesel to hydrogen to CNG or whatever. So you really take the energy you could take out of the fuel and you compare that energy to make it fair. It's nothing else but fair. The vehicle has to have a minimum track width of 50 centimeters. So that, of course, defines that it's a one-person vehicle. It has to have 3 or 4 wheels. So a 2-wheeler wouldn't be allowed. The minimum weight of the driver has to be 45 kilograms, so 90 pounds. But of course, if the driver is less than 45 kilo, you have to put additional weight, but you can't put that weight where you want to. So that's an advantage. Our driver is quite exactly 45 kilo because she's a student and she's not a child. Other teams are using children for driver. We don't think that is really fair. I mean, weight is everything, really. The driver must have sufficient visibility through the windows, so no video cameras are allowed to check visibility. And the last point I already had. So yeah, the main consequence, you really have to optimize everything to get the world record and to win that event. So you optimize primarily weight, frontal area, aerodynamics, friction, powertrain, control strategy. So this is a comparison of PACCAR 1, so the first fuel cell car we made, and PACCAR 2. And first, when we started with PACCAR, everybody said, "Hey, wow, that car looks great." And now when we see PACCAR 2, we think, "Ma, it does not look so great." the figures down here, for me as an engineer, are the more impressive part. So we reduced the weight from PACCAR 1 of 73 kilos to 32 kilos. So a bit more than 60 pounds. We reduced the frontal area from 0.45 to 0.25 square meters. Of course, you see the car is much smaller than this one here. and we improved the tank-to-wheel efficiency of the drivetrain from estimated 25% to a target value of 50%. We did not reach yet our 50% in the last competition, so there's still room for improvement, and we hope that we will reach that value in the next competition. So now going to some of the details. So here you see the car in a CAD drawing. You see that the two front wheels, they are stiff. So we went for a rear-wheel steering and rear-wheel drive. This is optimal because the rolling friction can be optimized like that, because all the angles are always perfectly adjusted as they have to be. Now, if you look at the front axle, you see those tilted wheels. Now, the tilted wheels itself are not optimal for rolling friction. But if you take into account the tilted wheels and the housing, then you see that you can reduce the frontal area by tilting the wheels. So it's a compromise between making a little bit a larger friction coefficient, rolling friction coefficient, but having a smaller frontal area. And here you see the powertrain. That's the wheel here with a hydraulic disc, braking disc, and here we have the two motors. Afterwards, we will have a better picture on that. So the front axle, improvements are less weight, of course. As I told already, weight is everything. 32 kilos, you're really fighting for every 100 grams. We used new ceramic bearings with less frictions in the wheels here. And that's an important point. We did not have any misalignment on the front wheels. That's due to the rear wheel steering. Rear wheel steering was designed as a neutral steering. There's a bit of risk taking a rear wheel steering, because all of you know, if you're driving backwards with your car, it's much more difficult to keep the lane when driving backwards. So the driver had to train a little bit to get used to that. But since we had a very clever steering mechanism, it's very good for them to drive. So here you see how the driver is within the car. So she lies in the car. And in the back here, that's the wheel. The powertrain is directly mounted on the wheel, so to save weight again. Here you see the holding part of the rear wheel. This is the disc brake. These are two independent hydraulic disc brakes. And here we have the two motors. The two motors are only engaged if you really want to power the vehicle. So we're having two servos. One is mounted here, one is dismounted on this picture here, which pull the motor onto that cogwheel here. The improvements, again, less weight. Oh, wow, 5 minutes. Less weight and a very good, well, motor-to-wheel efficiency. Aerodynamics, I mean, if you look at that car, and if you look at that at this car here, you understand that it's much better. But, of course, we did everything by simulation, by CFD simulation, to really optimize the thing. Frontal area, as I already told, is very important. So we really did a lot of investigation. How does the driver look out of the windows? How is the position that she feels comfortable? Because it's important if you're driving 50 minutes in such a car. You have to feel comfortable. CD value has been optimized to a value of 0.09. This value is measured in the wind tunnel with a 1-2 model. Just at the moment, they're testing the real car in the wind tunnel, and I'm very curious if that value still remains. But I think so, it will. Then, of course, we had a lightweight construction on the packed car chassis. So we have a load-carrying shell. We have no chassis. We have a carbon fiber material to save weight. We did a lot of investigation to optimize the different materials on the shell. I don't go too much into detail. We made deformation and strain analysis with CFD. We really optimized everything. Now, for the fuel cell system, one interesting point is a fuel cell has to be tight, because the fuel cell is fed by air and hydrogen. And if the hydrogen escapes in the fuel cell, you lose. So the fuel cell has to be put under pressure of about 2.5 tons. And these straps have to apply these 2.5 tons on the fuel cell to make it tight. And of course the forces have to be distributed on the fuel cell with such a special construction. And a spin-off company of ETH helped us with that. And with this special construction, we had a weight reduction of 700% compared to the earlier one. So this is how the fuel cell itself looks like in PACCAR 2. The fuel cell itself is just behind the driver, between driver and wheel. Space optimally mounted, of course. Weight optimally as well. Tanks. In PACCAR 1, we had a metal hydride tank which weighed 1.5 kilo. It could carry 16 grams of hydrogen. In PACCAR 2, we're having two bottles with compressed hydrogen, each 0.3 kilo, carrying 2 grams of hydrogen. Compressor optimized in weight. We're running the compressor in a duty cycle mode to be more efficient. Electronics optimized as well. We're having an overall efficiency in our DC-DC converter of about 95%. It's really optimized for that project. We made it by ourselves. The two boards communicate via fiber optics. High-level control is on this board. Low-level control is on this board here. You see gold-plated contact plates so that no oxidation can take place. We, of course, optimized temperature, operating temperature of the fuel cell, pressure of the fuel cell, and we reached a stack efficiency only of over 65%, which gave us a tank-to-wheel efficiency increase from 32 to 44%, and I personally think that these 44% are a conservative estimation, so we'll probably have more than 44% tank-to-wheel efficiency. And the result, you see it on the picture, we used 1.75 gram of hydrogen for those 25 kilometers. And if you calculate with the heating value, these 1.75 grams, and you calculate how large is the distance you could have covered with 1 liter of gasoline, you come to these 3,836 kilometers, which is roughly 9,500 miles per gallon. 9,500 miles per gallon. And this is the result of a track which is not optimized. Excuse me? Fast? Yeah, it's 9,500 miles per gallon. Is it not? That's miles per gallon, yeah. Okay. And the vehicle itself was not optimized for this competition, for Nogal. It's optimized for the competition which will take place in July, beginning of July. That's our second attempt. And there we think we will increase this number even more. So, conclusion. Efficient vehicles must be light, small, aerodynamic, and have a very efficient powertrain. And we really tried to do everything in that car. We really optimized the system. And often people ask me, hey, that's competition car. Why do you do that? First, we had a lot of fun. And second, the optimization methodology. We can apply this methodology also to a lot of other problems. So this is the kind of methodology we usually use in projects with our industrial partner, where we focus on improving the efficiency of three-way catalytic converters, doing emission modeling for diesel engine, doing downsizing of gasoline engines, and so on. But the optimization methodology is actually the same. And also the fact that the overall system has to be optimized. And I really want to thank again everybody who was involved in that project, and I want to thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Chris. That's really extremely impressive, and the 9,500 miles per gallon. And, you know, I think it would be amazing if we get to the point where, you know, when I go to visit my doctor for my physical, they say, you know, if you lost another 5 pounds, you'd improve your fuel efficiency. So our next speaker is Philip Dietrich, who is from PSI. And Philip is the project leader of the Highlight concept car. which was developed with Michelin. And Philip is going to detail the new electrical drivetrain and a fuel cell that operates on 100% renewable energy, hydrogen and pure oxygen. And for those who have been sort of following the evolution of the For those who have been following the evolution of fuel cell vehicles, one of the major questions is what will the fuel source be? And, of course, natural gas is what is being used mostly to produce the hydrogen fuel, but there is a lot of promise that Philip's going to talk about for much cleaner ways to develop that hydrogen fuel. So, Philip.
Thank you very much. You heard what are the limits, and we tried to get these limits transferred to a vehicle where we can use on a daily basis. Why we are working on that you see these are estimates where the need for transportation will go. And you see, if you look in the history and the extrapolation, you will see that more or less each 30 years there's a doubling of the kilometers per person which wants to be traveled. And another point is, if you look that we are looking more or less independent on the culture we are living, that we are spending about 1.2 hours per day in commuting and looking for food. And also we are spending about 10 to 15% of our income for transportation. Meaning, if we are earning more, we are spending more, and therefore the speed will go up. And this is what you see, and you don't have to look every specific dot, but the trend is that in all continents, the trend goes toward more transportation needs. If we want really to keep at least in the same level the energy for this transportation needs, we have to increase dramatically the efficiency of the transportation we take. And there's another interesting figure. You see, we have made transportation or changing down on the right. We have on the triangle renewables and nuclear. Then we had an age of coal and oil and gas. And as you see here, you see there's a circle, but it's not really a circle. It's a spiral because the amount of energy we're using between 1850 and now or in the future is dramatically increased. So I think we have to go back towards renewable energies. Also, if we want to use today technology which can improve the efficiency, normally it's not a free lunch. So we have to spend or look for ways in which optimal way we can increase the efficiency towards the cost we have to spend. We are specifically looking at 2 points, and you can operate on fuels and on technologies to change that fuels. One way we can look is clean, efficient values with compressed natural gas. This is a project where within the ETH domain, together with industrial partner, looked at transferring a combustion engine specific designed for compressed natural gas. And the advantage is you can get quite a lot of reduction on greenhouse gas emission towards today's cars, more or less at the same energy efficiency as you have already. So that's an improve to reduce global warming impact. Also, if you use compressed natural gas, that is the concentration of nitrogen oxides in the air, which is that line here. And with that car, you can have a short peak after the start. You see the level of emission is below the level of you have in the air, meaning you really have for that emission air cleaning machine. So there is some potential if you design cars of a specific fuels, you can gain quite a lot in potential. Therefore, you see it's possible to increase the efficiency on about 20%, at the range, which is still reasonable, not comparable as a diesel, but still in a range where it's convenient to use, and you still have here already cars sold, which are more or less that range of range, also on gasoline. This is a project together between ETH and EMPA, but looking on specific today's technology transferred with another fuel. If we go a step further and we are looking into a fuel cell, which means we have to change the fuel and the conversion of energy into the car, we come to the fuel cell, which means this is the transfer from hydrogen by a chemical process directly in electricity. You use hydrogen in a car, and we can say hydrogen is used today quite often in industry, and therefore safety standards are known and handled day by day. It needs a change in perception of safety for the clients. Also, gasoline is not has some hazardous potential, and to store hydrogen on cars, you need to compress it or cool it, but we prefer compress because that's the that needs the least energy. And we think that onboard reformer, you can also reform or produce the hydrogen onboard. We think that's quite complicated. Concerning the safety, we have specialists, we say it's manageable, and you see different, or the danger comes differently. For example, if you compare two cars 5 seconds and 1 minute after burning with the same amount of energy, you see hydrogen is burning fast and upwards because it's so light, and gasoline stays on the ground. Therefore, we say we use most efficiently energy, and to use that, also Chris told, lightweight construction is very important and an efficient converter. We put that into a car together with Michelin. It's a lightweight construction, the same efficient fuel cell technology. Actually, we got an efficiency between the tank and the wheel of about 60%, still better than the pack car. And meaning that in to get a car with a 4-seater where you can drive more or less the whole time, we can achieve an efficiency or mileage consumption in the range compared to gasoline 120 miles per gallon. So how we can do that? You combine the fuel cell, you have a super cap, which is an out battery, and an electrical powertrain. The advantage from that is you can integrate these electromotors directly into the wheels. So you have much more space where you can design or use differently. So you don't have to have a transmission, you don't have to have a tile pipe. So you have a lot of space where you can arrange differently. A supercap model is used as a battery, so by braking you can restore the energy and use it on the next acceleration. So altogether, we got a vehicle with about 850 kilogram, has still a pretty good acceleration. In 12 seconds we are of 100 kilometers per hour, and we have also a range of 400 kilometers, and that all with a consumption of about 120 miles per gallon transferred. The power we can get is about 30 kilowatt out of the fuel cell power, and for a short term we can get another 30 to 40 kilowatt out of the supercap, which is more or less the same power level you are used to in your today's car. Why using hydrogen and I think or gas compressed gas? You see, if you want to have the same efficiency at the end, and you're starting from natural gas and transfer it to hydrogen, which meaning you're losing about 60 to 70%, you have to be 1.4 times more efficient in the car to get the same value. So that's a way. We still think we are better than 1.4 times better than natural gas, but I think We have different ways to produce hydrogen and natural gas in parallel, and that, about that we are we'll discuss later this afternoon. We still can think about from what sources we can use hydrogen, or do we need hydrogen, and there are ways to use the solar energy directly, but I think again, I'm not so sure if this solution is usable for each day's purpose. One problem we are still working today is if you're using hydrogen, you have to look that you take your gas station with you, or at least in California, there are ways already, perhaps Dan will speak later on, where we can go on a normal gas station to pick up the hydrogen. But I think that's a way to say there are ways, if you are clever combining the technology, it needs a redesign of the car, there are ways to increase the efficiency of today's car than more than factor two. So that's the message. It's not yet for everybody today, but there are ways. We have driven several thousand kilometers with that car. It's working quite well. The acceptance is very interesting, and people are driving with that car are very astonished how good it feels. Also, if you only have 100 horsepower and not 200 or 300, but the acceleration behavior, since the car is light, is quite similar. So that's the message. We are not there for everybody, but I think we can say ways or see ways where it can go. At least from the technology standpoint, that's my message so far. We'll talk later about fuel.
Thank you very much, Philip. While Dan Sperling is setting up for his presentation, which is going to focus on future consumer buying trends and the transition to sustainable fuels, let me just say a couple of things, one of which is that Governor Schwarzenegger is apparently going to be making an announcement later this afternoon about some initiatives involving hydrogen fuels, and you all are going to get a sneak preview because Dan is the one who's advising him on that. So I also wanted to say that this is really critical, the issue of what the marketplace and consumers will actually accept. And I'll just tell you a very personal story. As the executive director of City Carshare, and for those who are not from San Francisco, City Carshare is our local car sharing organization. There are several hundred in Europe, but we were one of the very first in the United States, and we are the largest nonprofit car sharing group. We have over 4,000 members sharing 85 cars. So you think about that. We use the internet and our reservation system that we developed to allow those 4,000 people to gain access to a distributed all throughout neighborhoods around San Francisco, Oakland, and Berkeley. And one of the things we found is we, as an environmental organization, wanted to use the cleanest vehicles we could. And we started off using some battery electric vehicles. And we found out that they didn't work very well in our application. It was very difficult for people to understand how to use them. There was a long recharging time. And as I learned the hard way, people used to say that the electric vehicle was the car of the future, or the battery electric vehicle was the car of the future 25 years ago, and it probably will be the car of the future 25 years from now, but it's not going to be the car for today. And so we've moved City Carshare to hybrids, and we have a large percentage of our fleet now are both Toyota Prius and Honda Civic hybrids. We found that even those vehicles, it's very important to think about what the consumers will accept, what people will actually use, and so we've gone to great lengths to try to make all of the vehicles in our fleet, regardless of what the fuel type is, regardless of what the technology, to make them very easy to use. And that's something that that Dan, in his work, has not forgotten, and bridging the gap between the very critical future technology-oriented discussions that you've heard from Chris and Philip, and moving toward what is the marketplace going to accept, and how do we get these new technologies, cleaner fuels, cleaner cars, onto the roads and being used by average folks. And that's something that Dan has focused in his research. So let me turn it over to Dan Sperling.
Thank you very much. And if I have time, I'm actually going to say some nice things about car sharing, so maybe Larry will give me a little more time.
How much do you want?
Okay, to start off kind of this European or an international type setting here. So I have a slide here from France, but this is, I think, a very instructive slide. This is a very clever, good analysis that was done. And basically what it shows us is that we as humans have traveled more and more over time. In fact, it's increased exponentially over the last few centuries. And, you know, the question is, you know, where does that curve go in the future? Clearly, there's a demand, continuing strong demand for mobility and accessibility. How that will be met is an important question. So we'll come back to that, but keep that in your minds because, you know, this is really so important. You know, sometimes some of us in academia and sometimes in the policy world act rather elitist and say, you know, people shouldn't drive so much and should have little cars and walk. But people don't want to do that. In fact, you know, there's some research that shows that people are hardwired to want more. You know, they want bigger houses, you know, bigger cars. And socially, we're hardwired to want more interaction. So I think we need to keep that in our minds as we think about how do we create a more sustainable world. So, you know, one reality is that, again, another fundamental trend is that everywhere in the world, every city in the world is becoming less dense, is spreading out. Population density, land use density is decreasing. This is true in Europe, this is true in China, this is true in the United States. And if we bring that to the United States, you know, we see a story where the amount of travel, okay, the one acronym you have to remember here, VMT, vehicle miles traveled. Basically, it's how much we travel in our motor vehicles. And for this time period, I haven't updated it, but for this time period, 1970 to 96, population increased 29%, amount of vehicle travel increased 121%, over four times as fast. And that's a trend we see everywhere in the world. In the United States, actually, that trend is not so high anymore. It's not increasing quite that fast. But it continues to be the reality that we face. And actually, that blue line at the bottom is another one that plays a very important role in here, is that we travel a lot more, but we don't want to build any roads, you know, NIMBYism. We don't want another road in our backyard. And so, you know, what does that mean? Well, you know, you don't have to be a transportation expert to know that that means more congestion. And so we bring, you know, again, in the United States here, we have a story where motor vehicles have, you know, won the war. You know, they dominate travel in the United States. Transit, you know, those of you living in San Francisco might be out of touch with this reality of the rest of the country, but only 2% of the travel in the United States is by mass transit. It's actually dipped below 2%. 2%. About 85% is cars, and most of the rest is by plane. Not only that, 60% of the households have two or more vehicles. And probably the most stunning factoid here is the last one. We now have more than one vehicle per driver in the United States. You know, think about that for a moment. Okay, and so here's the history of the car ownership in the United States. This graph shows how vehicle ownership has increased over time since the beginning of the last century. And it shows that we're now up to about 800 vehicles per 1,000 people, you know, 8 per 10. And we've kind of left most of the rest of the world in the dust here, but some of them are catching up. Europe is not that far behind. China is way down there at the bottom. All they have to do is increase to 50 or 100 vehicles per 1,000, and that's going to, you know, mean a massive increase in vehicles and energy use and pollution and greenhouse gases. So it's not that all the countries, other countries are going to follow the U.S. on this curve upward. Just so you understand, the spot on the curve is where they are right now, whereas this is a dynamic one for the U.S. where it's gone over time. And they're not necessarily going to follow that. In fact, almost none of them will follow it. but they are continuing to increase. And part of what's going on is in the developing world, which has right now many fewer vehicles per capita than we do, there's explosive growth going on. And part of the reason is because vehicles have become so cheap. And when I say so cheap, it's not because they're buying, an Escalade SUV. It's because they're buying motorcycles, scooters. They're buying in China. There's 25 million of these rural vehicles, little vehicles out in the small cities that have one-cylinder diesel engines. But all of them use energy. And in fact, most of them use it rather inefficiently for what they are. And so the whole motorization process is really accelerating, especially in Asia. The good news, the good news here, like I started out, is, people are getting a lot of mobility and accessibility. This is good. The bad news, of course, is this means a lot more energy, a lot more pollution, a lot more CO2, traffic deaths. So what's going on here about, all these cars that we want? Okay, well, this might be part of it, prestige and status. Can we blame advertising for all this? It says here, for the first years of our lives, our parents made major decisions for us. Then, when we're old enough, they hand over the responsibility to advertisers. Well, the reality is that wherever you look in the rest of the world, in the United States over history, is that, and Philippe showed us, had a slide that was had the same idea here, is that as we get more money, we buy more vehicles. We see that everywhere. We see it everywhere. And in fact, any economics term is the elasticity of vehicle purchase is very high. We get an extra dollar. The statistics are for every 10% increase in our income, we spend 10% more on vehicles, worldwide. That's the experience that we have here. Now, again, bringing it back to the U.S. again, here's one of the really important parts of this story, and that is fuel economy. And this is the fuel economy over time for cars and for light trucks, our minivans and SUVs and pickups. And what you see, it's been basically flat over the last 20 years. But because we've shifted more to the minivans and especially the SUVs and pickups, the overall average has gone down. So our average fuel economy of our vehicles is now less than it was 20 years ago. Not what you call progress. And what's happened over that time is actually a remarkable story that I want to emphasize here, because over this period where the fuel economy basically stayed the same, the vehicles became much heavier. They became much more powerful. Vehicles used to, in the 80s, it would take on average 14 seconds to go from 0 to 60. That was the average. The average now is less than 10 seconds and is dropping. Okay, so what we've done is we've made our vehicles much more powerful, bigger, and heavier. But remember, we've done it without worsening fuel economy. So that's actually the good news part of it. The good news part of it is there's been tremendous innovation in the automotive industry. They've done a great job of developing and introducing efficiency innovations and making our vehicles more efficient. The point I want to make is efficiency does not equal fuel economy. Fuel economy is miles per gallon. Okay, so all that fuel efficiency improvement has been used to make our vehicles, to allow our vehicles to be bigger and heavier and more powerful. And this is just a graph that shows it. It shows, the 0 to 60 time dropping from 15 seconds. This is a pen. Thank you. So, thanks. Larry's the high-tech guy around here. You can. So the 0-60 was over 14 seconds. See, it's down to less than 10. The weight was over 4,000 pounds, dropped down to about 3,300, 3,200, and now, you know, and then has started going up again.
This is U.S.
This is U.S. I'm going to show you the rest of the world in a moment. So the story here, this is serious. You know, I used to have a joke slide, you know, that showed a make-believe car. This is a real thing. And look at it. It's 4.5 feet longer than a Hummer, 2 feet higher than a Hummer. It's much bigger than a Hummer. This thing is for sale. I think it's something like $90,000. You can go out and buy it. I actually saw one on a road. This is true story. So, but the point of it would be that, you know, the last part of it here, you know, as a hybrid, because indeed what we're doing is making our vehicles bigger and more powerful, but we are introducing efficiency and innovations into them. So here we are. This will be a vehicle that'll have a hybrid and have relatively modest fuel economy, even though it's so huge. And so, you know, the story is not so depressing in the rest of the world. It's not great, but it's better than in the but it's better elsewhere. And this just shows the fuel economy for vehicles adjusted to our mile per gallons for the rest of the world. So, you know, here's the U.S. down here, you know, Japan and EU and China and everyone else, the rest of the world up there. Here in California, we can feel good. We have new standards that have been passed into law in the previous Democratic administration and supported by the current Republican administration for greenhouse gas standards that would essentially result in this improvement. Now, it is in the courts, and the Bush administration is fighting it, the car industry is fighting it, but there's hope. So the story here is that, you know, the transportation trends in the United States are not in any way what you would call sustainable. The transit share is dropping, less than 2%. Vehicle ownership and use is increasing. Land use densities are decreasing. Fuel economy has been worsening for the vehicles. Greenhouse gas emissions have been increasing. So, you know, we think of that as there's behavioral solutions to this and there's technology solutions. You know, in reality, it's a mix of the two. But, you know, for now, let's talk about, think about them in terms of those two different approaches. So one thing is we certainly need green technology. We've got to improve the technology. You've seen that somewhere, right? But, you know, here's a, you know, before we get into these options too much, this is a slide I think that's one of the most important slides, graphs that exist. And this was done, this is done by the scientists, the IPCC, about for climate change. And what it shows is the CO2 being emitted into the, but this is for the world. This is the graph, the forecast, business as usual, what's going to happen with CO2. And you see the baseline, it goes up into the future. You can see that we're going up to 2200 here, so this is a long future here. But, you know, you see a continuing increase. If we want to stabilize CO2, you know, right now we're at about 350. You know, pre-industrial era it was 275 parts per million. We're up to about 375 now. Most scientists say that to go much above 450 is starting to get a little, you know, worrisome. You go up to 550 and you're really risking some, you know, potentially cataclysmic changes in our climate. So, but say we want to stabilize at 550, which is way above where we are now. This shows that we have to get on this graph here, this green one, and get on that graph to be able to stabilize it. And what, if you look at it, say for 2050, the difference between there and there is about a 30% reduction. So what we're talking about, even in the next few decades, we need to be thinking about a 30% reduction in our CO2. Not 5%, not even holding it constant, but a substantial reduction. And then as you go into up to 2100, you're talking about, you know, a 50% or more reduction. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion about we need behavioral solutions and technological. I think in the end, you can only do these kinds of dramatic changes with technology. And, you know, certainly you need behavioral changes to go along with the technology. So technology is not this just autonomous thing. You wait for, you know, Chevron to, you know, invent this great fuel, or GM or Toyota to come up with a great car. There's a lot of behavioral change that has to go along with it. But I think this is a graph I think all of us should really keep in mind as we think about the future. So what are these solutions? Well, diesel is something that's especially promoted in Europe. And you see here that, you know, much less so in the United States. We only have about 2 or 3% of our vehicles. This is light-duty vehicles, you know, being diesel. In Europe, it's, where's Europe? You know, it's up around 45% already. And diesel is good in the sense that it is much better fuel efficiency. And so you get considerably lower CO2 emissions. You know, in the United States, we've had a bad history with diesel, and there's a lot of debate about it, but this is certainly a part of the solution set we need to be thinking about. And then we have our battery electrics vehicles. You know, this is my kind of memorial slide. you know, some of you that have been particularly followed it, you know, these are many. This is the GM General Motors EV1, the Honda. This is the Toyota Econ. It never actually went into full production. The Bombardier neighborhood car, Nissan, the Think, Ford Think car. I think they're going to be back. I think as we start thinking about those 30 and 50% reductions, we're going to have to think very differently about the future. And part of it is thinking differently about transportation. We have to think about how we can use different types of vehicles. Battery electric is never going to be the dominant vehicle, but it works very well in limited applications. And since we have, you know, more than one car per driver, remember, why not be able to have households have a fleet of vehicles now. So why not have a household having a fleet where one of them is a small vehicle used for local travel, which is very efficient, zero emitting, and so on. So, and this is just a slide showing that most of our travel is rather short. So it's not like this is a big stretch to think that all of our vehicles have to be used for all purposes. And I'll come back to this idea in a moment. So then we have our hybrid vehicles. And the concept of hybrids is very appealing. You know, what we're doing is we're basically taking the gasoline engine and operating it where it's most efficient, and then complementing it with an electric motor and batteries. And so we can downsize the motor, the engine, we can operate it in an efficient way, and we can actually, with the batteries, get back the braking energy. And so the concept of hybrid vehicles is very attractive. And, you know, out here in California, we've been more exposed to it than most of the world. And we've seen, we had the first Prius that came out 4 or 5 years ago. I had one of those. I just traded it in for one of the new Priuses a few days ago. And the difference between the old and the new is dramatic. You know, that they really improved the technology dramatically. You know, just as a simple thing, the new one has better fuel economy, lower emissions, is bigger, is faster, and costs about the same amount. You know, it's really a remarkable story. The battery is warrantied for 150,000 miles. So the point here is hybrid technology is really on an upward trajectory, and it's going to be improved a lot more from where it is now. And these are the hybrid vehicles that have come out in the last couple of years, and the numbers are just increasing. You know, most of the car companies are going to be bringing out hybrid vehicles, so they're going to play a larger and larger role in the transportation system. And these are just some forecasts. By the way, you see a lot of my slides. You know, I borrow slides from everyone here, so I try to honor the origin by leaving it in. This is an EPA slide, for instance, that you see up there. So they just did a forecast there that shows, you know, kind of forecast of what's going to happen with hybrid vehicles. It's still a long ways until it gets to be a major part of the market, but it is increasing. And, you know, a point I want to make is that hybrid vehicles and diesel vehicles are not the solution if we're thinking about that 30% or 50% reduction, because vehicle travel is increasing about 2% per year in the U.S. It's increasing more in most other places. Increasing 2%. So that means we have to basically reduce our fuel consumption about 2% per year. That's about what we, if we spent, you know, we took all of those efficiency benefits from hybrids and used them for fuel economy, that's about what we could probably get. So we could probably stabilize. The history is, though, as we saw before, is that all of that efficiency advantage did not go for fuel economy, went for other stuff. And in fact, the same thing is happening with hybrids. And so this is actually an important point. You know, the point is policy matters. Look at hybrid vehicles. What are the new hybrid vehicles like? The new hybrid, Honda Accord, the new Lexus hybrid, those are being sold for performance. Those things are their best performing vehicles in that model segment. They're the fastest, most powerful vehicles that they sell. You know, the best Accord, the fastest Accord is the hybrid. So what they're doing is using that efficiency benefit for power. They're not, and they could be using it all for fuel economy. They're not, because that's what sells. So we need policy to intervene to make sure that some of that benefit does go to the public good, to fuel economy. Okay, and then there's the hydrogen economy. I think it's a great idea. It provides the potential for eliminating oil use, eliminating greenhouse gases, eliminating pollution. This is really something we've got to engage in a serious way. But it's not going to happen tomorrow morning or tonight or really soon. This is a graph from the National Academy study on hydrogen. It shows the most optimistic scenario is that we'll get to 10% replacement of oil in 2027. And that's a very optimistic forecast. So it really comes down to the customer. You know, business people like to talk about this, but they're right. You know, it's like, what are we as customers willing to pay for? And the secret, you know, fuel cells and has to be, and hydrogen have to be an important part of that future. And the question is, why would anyone buy a fuel cell vehicle? How are they ever going to get in the market? Well, there are good answers to that. And it's because fuel cells will almost definitely be perceived as better vehicles, as better technologies, than the competition, than, you know, gasoline or even hybrids probably, both from the customer perspective as well as from the car company perspective. And that car company's perspective is key, because if they're not willing to invest, if they're not willing to put their money into it and lead the way, it's not going to happen. So what are the advantages? Okay, from a customer perspective, a hydrogen vehicle has, you know, it has all the environmental benefits. But also, it drives like an electric vehicle, and all of our market research shows people actually prefer that. It has a high torque. It also, it can be used for, there can be all kinds of things it can be used for. You can plug it into your house potentially as emergency backup power when we get all these increasing blackouts. And we have all these devices in our house that are, you know, all these, you know, you have to reset all your devices all the time. Well, you can plug in your car. You can do that. From a car company perspective now, this makes it great. They don't have to deal with the regulators anymore because it doesn't have any emissions. They can actually, it opens up the whole design envelope, because now you can take that whole fuel cell system, put it in the chassis of the chassis of the vehicle, and now you can design the vehicle any way you want. You're not constrained by the engine and the transmission and the drivetrain and all those kinds of things. So you can do it very differently. You have all this power on the vehicle. You can use that power for all kinds of new accessories and services that we haven't even dreamed of. And, you know, this isn't all good, but this is what will make it attractive. Because, well, this is some example of all those kinds of things. And, you know, this is half joke but half reality, because this, in fact, is what's going to happen, these kinds of things. You know, we're just starting to dream up all of those things you can do, but all these things use energy. So it's back to that same old thing. We get the efficiency advantage, but then what do we do with that efficiency advantage? So, you know, okay, very quickly. So why would anyone buy these clean, efficient vehicles? Well, in the case of the fuel cells, I told you a little. Well, we're doing a lot of research at UC Davis trying to figure out, you know, are buyers rational? You know, if the If we can provide them a vehicle more fuel efficient, are they going to buy it? Do they value fuel economy? And why the heck are they paying $4,000 extra for a hybrid vehicle? What's going on here? Why are they willing to do that? Let me move along a little quick. So here's one survey that was done. It said, if we could give you a car with an engine that would save you $400 in fuel every year, exactly the same, how much would you be willing to pay for that vehicle? Well, you know, some said none. some said 2,000 or more, but it's kind of, you know, all over the place, right? So, you know, are they thinking? And then we have up there here, and then even those up there, you know, at the top that they're willing to pay, what are they thinking? You know, it's not like, I mean, they're thinking, you might say more rationally, but in the interviews we're doing these intensive interviews, we have not found a single household where someone has said when they made a choice about buying a diesel car or hybrid or anything else, they did a calculation that if they paid that much extra for the car, they'd save this much, and therefore it was a good buy. In fact, this was included engineers, accountants, PhDs. No one thinks that way. No one thinks that way. So that's one of our findings. And so here's, you know, just another survey that was done. It says how much of a payback would you need, if you got better fuel economy. And, you know, the numbers are all over the place. 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 6 years. People don't think this way. And so, so how do they think? Well, okay, this is, you know, say, well, some people think, okay, how many years is my car financed? Some are just guessing. Some are optimists. Some, you know. Okay, so what we've learned is we have no idea how consumers think that, you know, but what we are doing is working at trying, you know, it's a fairly major research program funded by some different sources. And we're trying to figure out how do people think, because our hypothesis is people have never had the choice of making, never had an environmental choice when they buy their vehicle. You think back on it. If you want a vehicle of a certain size, the cars are all about the same fuel consumption. The emissions are about the same. You know, when do you ever really have a choice other than if you're going to take a little car versus a big car, for instance? And, you know, when we switch to unleaded fuel, you know, everything just switched. So consumers have never had, this is our hypothesis going, consumers have never really had a choice. And the hybrid vehicles seem to be the first time that they feel that they do have a choice. They can get a vehicle, you know, of high quality, get everything they want, and it has better fuel economy. And so we're thinking that's part of explaining what's going on with the hybrid phenomena. But meanwhile, we've come up with all kinds of different decision styles that people use. You know, some people do some kind of calculations that aren't exactly right, but, you know, they make some effort at it. You know, some people think in terms of threshold, you know, nothing worse than 20 mpg. Some people think, you know, well, it goes on and on, and, you know, some people want certain brands. Some people want the best technology. Some people grew up in the Depression and, you know, just want to be Scrooge-like. So, you know, some of the preliminary conclusions from this are that we find over and over again, you know, kind of joked a little about, you know, the economists and the financial analysts and accountants, but drivers are not making economically rational decisions. They're not thinking that way in terms of doing an explicit calculation about getting better fuel economy. It's just not happening. But they are making decisions, and so we're trying to figure out what those are. They're using indicators and symbols in their minds about what kind of vehicle they want and the attributes of it and what to them is a better vehicle and so on. So we're trying, you know, that's what those decision styles were all about. And with hybrid vehicles, it seems to be, our market research is showing that hybrid vehicles seem to be not a desire, you know, people are not going out there and saying, ah, it's better fuel, you know, I get, you know, 20% better fuel economy, I'm going to buy it. It's broader and different than that. It's a broader sense of, it's an expression of environmental value. It's like, this is a car that's good for the world, good for society. It's advanced technology. I'm doing something, doing the right thing. It feels right to them, but they're not sitting down and making explicit calculations about these. But we're working through this. So this is research in progress. Okay, now I have one more idea, and I'll go through this very quickly, and that is that there is, you know, I talked about the fuels in the vehicles. Well, there's a more fundamental transportation problem that I alluded to in the beginning, and that is that we essentially have a monoculture transportation system. We have a system and a land use system that's too dense for cars, not dense enough for conventional transit. We've created a transportation, this is United States, which is extreme compared to much of the world. It's a monoculture in the sense that, you know, all cars serve all purposes, all roads serve all vehicles have combustion engines that run on petroleum, almost all roads and all parking is free. We have this monoculture, and we're finding it very difficult to introduce any change or innovation, and that was one of the problems with the battery electric vehicles. People had to be willing to accept the shorter range, and they're not quite ready for that. And so there's lots of ideas, innovations that can be used, you know, that are going to be happening. One of them is Larry's pet effort with car sharing, which is a very important part of it. Smart paratransit, jitneys that go around where, you know, you just kind of check on your cell phone or your computer and it comes to your door and picks you up and delivers you. Dynamic ride sharing, which is an idea where you can basically, more informally, you can get picked up, you know, by someone going from here to there. They've been screened, of course, so they're not, you know, child molesters or anything like that. Neighborhood cars, vehicle, connecting your vehicle to the grid, you know, as backup for your house. So there's a lot of ideas, and we're not pursuing hardly any of them. This is kind of a characterization of it. This is a colleague of mine that works now at CalSTART, Dan Sturgis, who actually was the designer of the GEM vehicle, the GEM electric car that some of you might be familiar with, that thing right there. You know, we can start thinking of integrating all this together in ways where we don't have, every vehicle doesn't serve every purpose. We don't have to buy an SUV for that once every 2 year trip up to the mountains. And so the final closing thought here is that, you know, this is kind of a more philosophical thing here, is that we have, as a society, we make choices. Now, as with the fuel economy, we can do things that meet our private desires, you know, bigger car, bigger house, more power. But those choices have implications for the public, for the societal good. And every society makes choices along that spectrum. And every society falls in a different place on that spectrum. You know, Asia has more collective values. Europe has a history of more limited land and natural resources, more of a vulnerability to foreign conflicts. The U.S. values individualism, consumer sovereignty, has a history of open space and large frontiers. So the U.S. tends to fall more, you know, at the end towards relying on market forces and less government. And we have to understand and appreciate that and work with that. And this is the challenge, you know. We can't just say people should do this or shouldn't do that. We've got to figure out what works for our society and come up with the policies and the innovations and, of course, look back into our own behavior. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dan. Always very entertaining. Always entertaining. We have about 10 minutes for questions from the first three panelists. And if anyone has filled out a form, you get to go first. So if anybody has one of these, please send them to the aisle. Let's see, can I get, Phil, would you just help me to collect those?
Such a small audience.
Yes? Certainly. Okay. Felix Kramer, stand up. Ask your question.
If we make one big leap of assumption, I'm the founder of CalCar, the people who took a Prius and made a 150 mile per gallon vehicle, adding batteries to show that it was possible.
If we make a hypothetical assumption that somehow we're able to talk to things to build these kinds of vehicles, where do you see grid connected vehicles fitting into this paradigm in terms of a solution that doesn't require any new infrastructure plugged in at night and doesn't, you know, challenge the grid in any way and gets us 60% greenhouse gas reductions as soon as we get the cars on the road?
I do think the grid-connected hybrids is kind of a logical next step with the hybrids. The idea is, I don't know if you are all familiar with it, is it's the hybrid vehicle, but where even more of the power for the vehicle comes from the grid, from plugging it in. Yeah, but even much smaller gasoline engine and a relatively bigger electric motor and battery. And so what it does is it takes, you know, relies on electricity. It can tend to be a little even more efficient. And so it's certainly, it's part of the, you know, as we think of the long term, we don't have many good choices. We have hydrogen, we have electricity, which would be used either in a battery electric or in a plug-in, or could be used, you know, like in our buses in San Francisco, and then biofuels. And that's just about it, in, you know, on the technology and fuel side. And I think all of them are part of the solution. And the plug-in hybrids are an important part. In fact, they broaden out the potential for electric vehicles because electric vehicles do, you know, have the limitations due to the batteries. But with a plug-in, it overcomes a lot of that. So I think that's clearly part of it. But, you know, you got to get the car companies interested in this. And you know, they're conservative. You know, they're cautious and conservative. So that's the challenge. And the consumers have to be, because part of it is we as consumers have to get used to the idea that we're willing to buy a car and plug it in. I know with my new Prius, you know, I got a little nervous when I got in that new one. It had all this voice recognition technology and keyless entry. And, you know, I was a little nervous about all that technology. And yeah, anyway.
Great. Kurt Thirkelson? Yeah, go ahead. Ask a question.
I was just going to say that... Could you discuss like the remaining global oil reserves and just approximately, given our consumption rate right now, our projected consumption rate, how long approximately we might have left of oil?
Can you do that in the second
half? Yeah, we're going to be discussing that just after the break, and there's going to be a lot of discussion on that. Let's see, Tom Call.
Yes, hi. It seems to be, and I think Dan alluded to this, but particularly with Philip here, the technologies you were saying might be the answer. But I don't know what the answer to what, because as we get to those super high efficiencies, aren't we having the unintended consequence of more people driving more miles, and therefore, with the same number of highways, we're stuck in more traffic, and we may be producing more greenhouse gases, even though they're so tiny for each one?
Okay, I think it's more the time. You don't want to spend 3 or 4 hours a day in the car. So it depends. It's if you look at, if you're talking about cars, you limit it to about 30 to 50 miles per hour range. So, and this separates it in a certain way out, and you see that also in the US, that the miles effectively driven per person is in the car is more or less at the moment that flattened out. But there are new ways of transportation like planes or fast train, which adds to get a broader range. So if you're looking for that technology, for example, which is still the majority for the people, which is the car, or will be buses or public transportation, but you see that as soon as you have enough money, you see a switch from public transportation towards cars. And that means there we have to look at for this large segment which we will face in the next 20 to 30 years, we have to get very efficient cars, which also affects the fuel consumption, and it's not only fuel efficiency.
Yeah, we can't be against technology improvement. You know, that's not the solution. The solution is dealing with the policy world to deal with the adverse effects of improved, you know, the downside effects of technology.
Okay, we've got time for just a couple more questions right here.
William Stanford, if you were designing a transport system in China today so that China in the future, what would it be?
I'm going to give each of the panelists 1 minute to answer that question. We'll start with Chris.
I would give them a CNG solution because they have CNG resources themselves. With CNG, you can make zero emission, talk about toxic emissions, and you have very good fuel consumption. You can make a good downtime, you can do the supercharging, and
CNG. Okay,
I think, specifically in China, there will be a need to have a combination of public transportation and private or individual mobility. I cannot imagine how this dense country or these cities won't deal with the same mobility we are facing here. So I think, but that's a good part of the story is, if you have dense populations or cities, you have also the preconditions to get quite an efficient public or mass transportation system. So I think it will be a mix, and I guess if I look how accessible oil is to China, there might be a chance that, for example, electricity or hydrogen may be an initial phase to get there to a larger market, because China don't have to transfer an existing oil infrastructure, they have to build one new, and we can only hope or sustain or support them to build the right one.
Great. Okay, and then 1 minute. Clean sheet. It's not really clean sheet, but if you had a clean sheet, you'd start with a whole new type of transportation system. You'd have, here's what I would say, I'd have a line haul type service where you had little vehicles that went on as little pods on a with electrified road or third rail and with a little battery, and it could take off and they'd link together. Maybe those little vehicles could go into a big transit vehicle for the really long trips, so everyone could get, many people get personal. You put some big bus type vehicles on there also, and then you'd have it mostly electric, and you'd have mass transit and personal transport and be cheap.
Okay.
And if you believe that.
So to sum up, we've got CNG, electric, non-oil based, and pods, and I'm going to throw in car sharing.
Right.
Just got to do it. Got to do it. Okay. Okay. Last question, gentleman in the back there.
We had the political will, whatever it was, 25 years ago, to enforce fuel standards nationally. What's changed? Why can't we do that today?
Okay. I'm going to assume this goes to the American, since it was a question about American will, I think.
And since the Europeans and Japanese have done it, and we haven't, so actually it is an American question. Actually, it's a political answer. It's because the U.S. car companies are in bad financial shape and have been lagging in developing a lot of the more efficient technology, and through their legacy arrangements have a great difficulty in reducing their closing plants and laying off people. So therefore, any kind of initiative that is going to have any burden of any sort on the Detroit companies is going to be vociferously opposed by them because of the economic implication, because they can't shut down capacity easily. They don't have the technology to keep up, you know, in some of the more advanced areas. They're dependent on the big SUVs. And so all the politicians know that. Anything they do on fuel economy is going to adversely hit the Detroit companies, which means a lot of job losses, or at least that's the political story. And therefore, you have paralysis in Washington. And that's the reason we don't have paralysis in California, because we're not bound to those same political realities in California.
I know there were several more questions, but I want to be conscious of the time. We're going to have a very brief coffee break for 10 minutes. We have coffee, cookies, and soft drinks just outside. And please do come back. We have a very exciting panel. Going to be focusing on fuels and the path to alternative fuels. We thank our panel. Chris, Philip, and Dan. Welcome back, everyone. We're going to start part two of today's session, which is entitled The Path to Alternative Fuels. And the first presenter for our panel will be Jeff Tester. Jeff flew out this morning just for this event from Boston. So welcome, Jeff. Jeff is a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Not just a professor, he is the H.P. Meisner Professor of Chemical Engineering, and there'll be a special prize if anyone can tell me who H.P. Meisner was, or is he still alive?
No.
No. Who he was? I don't know. Jeff is at the at MIT. They have these great names. Actually, my favorite. I'm going to tell a little true story. My favorite name at MIT is Living Room of the Future is one of the laboratories at MIT. Anyway, I'll remember the other thing, but the Living Room of the Future is my favorite one. Anyway, Jeff is at the Laboratory for Energy and the Environment. His other assignments at MIT have included serving as the director of MIT's Energy Laboratory for over 10 years, serving as the director of MIT's School of Chemical Engineering Practice Program for almost a decade, and a group leader at the Geothermal Engineering Group at Los Alamos National Laboratory for 6 years. He is a member, was a member of the Energy Research and Development Panel of the President's Committee of Advisors on Science and Technology. And I read that and I was a little concerned, but for those of you who understand San Francisco politics, it was in 1997 that he served as the President's Committee of Advisors on Science and Technology, so not the current president. And Jeff has served as an advisor to the U.S. Department of Energy, the National Research Council, and many other national leading organizations. Let me turn it over to Jeff Tester.
Thanks. Thank you, Larry. I'm going to try to take a little bit different position here than what we've had in the first set of talks, in that we're going to talk about the whole energy system for a while and hopefully provide some context on what some of the other challenges are that are out there. We can't run our transportation system without energy in general, and most of that energy now comes from petroleum-based fuels. And if we're going to evolve to a new system, we have to kind of know where we're headed. I've had a lot of people that have provided background to me, and I certainly want to recognize them, John Haywood in particular, and the folks at the Sloan Auto Lab at MIT, as well as a number of people at the National Renewable Energy Lab, both its current management. They're the systems integrator for the country on the hydrogen program, so that's somewhat relevant to what we're going to talk about as the day goes on, and certainly to the current and former director. I might also, this is the advertisement part here, since we're in the teaching business, MIT Press is about to come out with a new textbook that we've worked on for a number of years that was designed to teach students and hopefully some of our policymakers how they can deal with a problem that has high uncertainty and a lot of attributes to it. This is a multiple-dimensional, multi-scale problem that engineers love to deal with, but policymakers have to deal with it as well. Choosing a sustainable path isn't just about global warming. It has a lot to do with driving our economy and equity issues that are out there that I'll try to get to. So if you're interested, I have some flyers here, and that's the end of the commercial. So as we look at this, There are many issues that energy connects to, but at least these three should resonate, I think, with what's been said already. Certainly, economic well-being and the quality of life, national and international security, and the environment at virtually all scales, from local pollution to regional to national issues as well as global issues. Now, are there problems that might be lying ahead that we might want to think about for future generations? We haven't talked a lot directly about population, but certainly it's a real issue because it reflects not only on growing demand, but in the kind of systems that will be developing as these economies in lesser developed countries mature. And certainly the way in which we supply energy and the sources where that comes from are very important. And you've heard a lot about carbon dioxide, and I guess I don't need to remind you of the facts of that, but that is a concern. Those are indicators that are out there. Now, you've seen a lot of graphs that use logarithmic scales here. I'm going to show you another two or three. A straight line on this semi-logarithmic plot of this is billions of people versus a linear scale here indicates an exponential kind of growth. And if you look at where we've been population-wise, we're roughly on a scale of, 2% per year. And clearly, this is not sustainable forever. These represent sort of predictions as to where we might be at the end of the next century, but of the range of maybe 10 billion people or more, all wanting to perhaps drive like we do. And worldwide energy consumption is another one, because part of this, about a third of this overall energy budget here, this is a unit of quads, which is a big number. In this course that we teach, we have students think about how large these numbers are, so we refuse to use any scientific notation. They have to write all the zeros out. This is 10 to the 15th BTUs, or 10 to the 15th joules, or if you like the metric system, each quad is an exajoule. It represents the equivalent of lots of barrels of oil equivalent or lots of tons of coal, but it's a nice way to look at the global sort of energy economy. And we're at about 400 or so of these right now. Where we might be at the end of the next century is a big question, and maybe more importantly, how we provide that energy. And this is on a growth path, which has some noise in it, but that straight line reflects a 3% growth, which clearly can't be sustained for another 1,000 years or so. Now, if you look at this graph shows you sort of where we were in 1995 with about 350 quads. That's already grown to 400. About 85% or so of that energy comes in three forms: oil, primarily for the transportation system, natural gas, and coal, which have a number of uses, but a big one, of course, today and growing even larger for natural gas is electricity, and coal is essentially all for electricity. Nuclear, again, for electricity, and then a small part down here in renewables. So if we took that 350 quads and we kept the distribution the same, in other words, roughly 85% of our energy budget here is coming from fossil fuels. So we keep this in this red box here. Some distribution, let's say, of oil, coal, and gas at the end of the century that we've just started. And we let it grow up to these projected levels of perhaps 2,000 quads or so. This is what this would look like. And it is business as usual on the curves that you see as projections, but I think there are many, many reasons why we won't get to this. One of them has to do with carbon. And again, this can be looked at either as carbon in terms of molecular carbon dioxide, the form that it's usually in, or just scaled down to the atoms or molecules of carbon. But again, it's growing in an exponential fashion up to where we are now. What will happen later is very important. Dan Sperling showed you a number of scenarios that have been generated about stabilizing carbon dioxide, but we have to be thinking about it. So one of the things that engineers think about is there an asymptotic world that we might envision? We talk about this a lot in this course we call Sustainable Energy. What would the population be and the primary energy demand? Interesting way to look at these units here. This is the 400 quads growing to 2,000 or so plus quads at the end of the next century, or some leveling out, let's say, of where we might be in global demand. If you put this in equivalent barrels of oil, the total energy content, this would be equivalent to burning up 1 billion barrels of oil every single day of the year. And we're obviously not going to provide that all with petroleum, but it is an interesting figure that you come out if you use this 2,000 quads. Carbon emissions, where we might be in gigatons, Dan showed you some graphs of that too, that's a big concern. Per capita energy consumption, there are lots of ways to look at this. This is in barrels of oil equivalent. How many trucks and cars we have, I had to revise my view graph now because Dan's showing a figure at the half century mark at 3 billion. where we might be. I think nobody really knows where we're going to be, but it's going to be a lot more than we have now. And the electricity demand is growing equally as fast. In fact, there's a tendency now both in developed countries as well as developing countries to have a higher fraction of their total primary energy being converted to electricity. So we've got lots of indicators that tell us where we might want to go. And many people think of this as transitioning from sort of the age we've been in for a long time, which is the age of hydrocarbons, to a new, more sustainable energy destination. What it consists of, no one knows exactly, because there are many ways to get there. But these issues have to be dealt with. Certainly, the pervasiveness of energy services and the sort of the way that system has been based on low-cost, abundant fossil fuels. Even in today's USA Today, I was reading on the plane coming out here, they traced the actual inflation-adjusted price of gasoline in the United States. And it's been virtually flat for over 70 years. There's been some fluctuations in it. I'd say that's another one of the issues that perhaps doesn't get us as excited about maybe transitioning to a more efficient transportation system, but it's out there anyways. And that makes it harder to justify additional costs that we might want to invest in new vehicles. Climate, the environment on all scales, and health concerns, resource limits, the linkage of global energy commodities now, and thinking of this as just something we can buy on the open market, sort of put against the idea of infrastructure security. You know, where does homeland security fit in all this when we talk about energy? So we need to think about options, and if we're going to go out and look at options, it seems to me we ought to have some sort of a plan. This is particularly true. I'm not sure who will give credit for this, but it's at least these two gentlemen looking at it quite differently. Making predictions is always difficult, particularly if it's about the future, and this one perhaps encapsulates what we've been doing in this country for a number of administrations. If you don't know where you're going with respect to energy, any road will do. And I think that is a problem. So here's our plan, or parts of it, and I've taken the liberty of kind of writing it in my own words. But we're certainly focused on reducing emissions of sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, carbon monoxide, and particulates, primarily from mobile but also stationary, particularly coal-fired power plants and the like. There is a statement in this plan about reducing our dependence on imported oil and also an increasing performance. These are good things to say, but they have to be backed up by real action. Certainly we're doing a number of things up in the top area, but I don't think much in this area. Certainly the data doesn't suggest that. So another part of this is that our energy goals are not focused on carbon management. That doesn't mean that corporations, as you'll hear today, aren't thinking about that, trying to anticipate what those goals might be and taking some positive action. But we don't really have any real legislated goals yet. What about homeland security? And some people like to think of this, you know, could we in some way make our system, our energy system, to inoculate it, if you will, to the supply and distribution system against not only terrorist issues, which I think have risen after 9/11 for sure, but just natural threats, storms, earthquakes, and the like, which could really disrupt supply. I think a lot of times the disruption of supply is something that really triggers change rather than just a slight shift in price. So if you're going to look at sustainability, connecting values to prices and costs, it seems to me, is sort of central to this. How much are we willing to pay? How much is avoiding a ton of carbon worth? Do we really want to be energy independent? Several administrations back, we had a plan called energy independence. What's the value of a natural resource, and are clean energy and high efficiency valued and priced properly? So we've got many things we can do here. No problem. There are renewables. There's a nuclear power option you might go. It probably has to be some sort of a diversified portfolio. And this is just one, not my proposal, but just to show you that here's where we were in 95, and this might be a more proposed, let's say, sustainable path, particularly if carbon is important. and limits, let's say, the supply of fossil fuels might be. So you have a big renewable portfolio down here that makes up about 40%. Nuclear power in some way, clearly a new generation over the systems we have now. Hopefully proliferation resistant and dealing with the waste problem and safety issues. And fossils still representing an important part, but not a bigger amount than we are now, which might make it more sustainable for the long term. But there are lots of barriers along the way if we want to achieve this. We have tremendous amount of embedded infrastructure. If you think about just the number of gasoline stations and high voltage transmission lines and miles of oil and gas pipelines, to change this system will not be easy. It will take a commitment, not just the commitment of one administration, but many administrations. And I think a lot of people who will want to see change occur must have some sort of ultimate destination in mind. You heard Dan Sperling's comments about having a lot of vehicles. There are almost as many vehicles in the United States, including what we'll call cars and light trucks, as we have people, not just registered drivers, but this is approaching the population of the country. And that's something to think about. Another feature here is the new vehicles that we're purchasing are seemingly highly distributed towards or moving in a direction towards light trucks. Perhaps that'll change now, but that's worsened the problem. I don't know what happened to this graph. That's interesting. This was a graph that showed that showed us
the sensors from the
yeah, that's right. It got to us. Yeah, it's just not here. Sorry, people. What can I say? If I were able to show this graph, let's see if we can get it this way. I don't think so. Well, if this graph was here, you would see that we're approaching now 60%, probably Arthur can correct me on this, but 60% of our petroleum right now is imported, 40% is domestic. And that's likely to get worse. In fact, the projections from the Department of Energy and the Energy Information Administration are that it will, in fact, grow. So here's a quiz for us. I got six answers here and one question. How do we reduce our dependence on foreign oil? That's a national goal we have now. Increase vehicle efficiency, number one. Decrease driving miles. Switch to alternative fuels. Drill for more oil on U.S. land or water. Any of the above or all of the above. Well, you think about what the answer might be. We're not doing a lot right now except perhaps thinking about drilling. But these issues are real, and you saw the kind of potential that's out there. So let's just look at answer three, because this is what this session has to do with. Can we transform ourselves to an alternative fuel system? Renewables have high sustainability scores and can produce carbon-neutral transportation fuels. But the quality and availability of renewables does vary widely across the country, and their costs are high relative to the fossil fuels that we've come so that are so near and dear to our hearts now. Here's the president's statement in his first two State of the Union messages back, where he actually took on hydrogen as being what seemed to be a national goal. How we actually transition to this is going to be important. What we have to remind people is that this is an energy carrier. It's not an energy source. We have to make hydrogen one way or the other. This little cartoon here, which we'll describe in much more detail as we go through these other talks, could have a hydrocarbon source. Methane is the way we make most of our hydrogen. We could electrolyze water directly from nuclear renewable sources, or we could do it by gasification of biomass. Any of those would have a route through electricity as well in electrolysis, and ultimately could be used in a number of ways to drive our energy system. There are issues that are out there, and you heard some of them touched on as we went through the talks in the first session. Shifting to hydrogen will require a big change in infrastructure. Storage is a real issue to deal with, the infrastructure to supply fuel, deliver it, and distribute it. And hydrogen production will have to shift now, not to just something that occurs in a distributed mode, but in a large, centralized way, in the way in which we handle refinery-grade, let's say, fuels that we're dealing with today. And all of these have to be safe, reliable, and at reasonable costs. Now, there's only two more slides here. we heard a lot in the first session about new technologies and the features that might be out there for vehicles, needing good fuel economy and range, safe and durable and acceptable cost, but they have to be things that people will want to buy. There's policy things that can incentivize that perhaps, but they just have to be good, well-engineered vehicles that have all these attributes. These three here, though, we haven't talked about a lot yet. Alternative fuels, the carbon-free sustainable production of these fuels, and the national infrastructures that we might need to supply, we will need to supply and distribute these. Well, to sum up, Mr. President, there's a lot of work left to do. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. And, we'll talk to the censors about that graph. I did want to mention, I failed to mention that in among his many advisory roles, Jeff serves on the advisory board of the Paul Scherrer Institute in Switzerland, which is, again, one of the sponsors of this event. So he, in many ways, embodies, as a professor at MIT and also as an advisor to the Paul Scherrer Institute, the collaboration across countries, the international collaboration here. So while we're getting set up for our next speaker, I'm going to ask, does anybody know, my question, does anybody know who H.P. Meisner was? Wait. Does anybody else other than our panelists? Okay, we have one.
I know who was Meisner for personal.
No.
Yes? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Anybody else in the audience? No.
We'll give a special
all right.
prize.
All right. No, I've got the special prize in my hand. Okay. Arthur, who was he?
Thermodynamics at MIT.
Very well known. Absolutely. Was he your professor?
No, he wasn't, but he was a good friend.
Okay, great. Well, you get some Swiss chocolate as a prize that I have right here.
Too, right?
So, and turns out he loves chocolate
right.
too. So your alma mater would be proud, and you'll tell the president of MIT that Arthur got the answer right. Okay. Great. Well, our next speaker, I won't do a full introduction because we've met him already, but Dan Sperling is going to come back and is going to talk to us again briefly about fuel production and pathways in U.S. public policy. So welcome back to the podium, Dan Sperling.
Thank you. Pleasure to be back. Okay, fuels. Well, we've seen this kind of graph. You know, business as usual, a lot more energy being used, a lot more oil being used, especially in the U.S. as well as elsewhere. Two-thirds of all the oil is used for transportation. So, to the extent there's an oil problem, it's largely a transportation problem. That's two-thirds in the U.S. Worldwide, it's about 50%, but the share keeps going up. Okay, now the interesting new point I want to introduce here is that, you know, it's this question of end of oil. You know, we keep reading all these books about, newspaper articles about, are we running out of oil? And I guess there was actually a question earlier about this. I would characterize it this way. First of all, we need to think about conventional oil versus what's sometimes called unconventional oil. Conventional oil is what we normally think of as oil. The unconventional oil is other sources that we can use to make gasoline and diesel that where the end fuel is identical, and the sources can be very similar or dissimilar. For instance, there's heavy oil, which is just a more thick, viscous type, which we have a lot of in California. Actually, there's been a lot of heavy oil in California that we use. The tar sands in Canada, which is basically little sand particles encased in tar-like oil. There's the very tar-like oil in Venezuela. All of these are already in production. We're making oil from gasoline and diesel from it. We go a little further out. We're using some of the remote natural gas that's far from a market, converting that into a fuel, a gasoline or a diesel fuel. We can do that. In fact, are doing that already as well. We can convert coal into liquids. And that's been well been established. And China is, has a lot of interest because they have a lot of coal there, but the United States as well. Oil shale, which actually was something that was done here and started to be done in the late 70s, early 80s, was abandoned. But, you know, if it goes far enough along this path, you know, that might be used. The point being that, you know, almost everyone says now we're going to see a peaking of conventional oil sometime in the next 10 to 40 years. And there's a lot of controversy about it. But the real point I want to make here is that we're already moving into unconventional oil. If you look at these are four graphs of four different scenarios of DOE, and in all of them, there's a big chunk, increasing chunk coming from unconventional oil. That's this pinkish color here. So in all of them, this unconventional. And that is important because, this unconventional stuff takes a lot more energy to get it out of the ground, a lot more energy to refine it. And so what we're talking about here are fuels that actually produce a lot more CO2. A gallon of gasoline in the future of this unconventional will produce a lot more CO2, you know, anywhere up to 60-70% extra CO2 per gallon, or even more than that, perhaps, depending on which one. So the business as usual case is not a reduction in CO2, but an increase in CO2. And that is something that, you know, is really crucial as we think about the future. And it's important because there is a lot of fossil energy out there. You know, the bottom here is the amount of oil we've used right there. And then there's all these other sources of fossil energy, all of which can be converted into gasoline and diesel. You know, the top one is speculative. Methane hydrates is methane really deep down and, you know, very cold, and there's a lot of question about it would be taken out, and at some cost it can be done. It's unclear at what cost. But all this other stuff is here and now. So the point being, you know, we always talk about decarbonizing our energy system. That's what we've been talking about. You know, we went from wood to coal to petroleum to natural gas, you know, a steady decarbonization. Well, now what we're doing is recarbonizing. You know, we're taking a turn in the wrong direction here in terms of our transportation energy. This is an example of the tar sands. So it's not just the carbon, by the way. These places where these resources are being taken out of the ground have huge environmental effects in terms of not just the energy, but the water and the landscape and so on. And so here's just the tar sands. So you see tar sands, it's well over a million barrels a day now, and it's, you know, and they're just investing more and more in it. They can produce it now for $15 a barrel, you know, or so. So this is competitive, you know, at much less than $50 a barrel, and a lot of those others as well. And if the green, in terms of the tar sands, you know, these are the numbers. If it's a surface mine, it's about a 40% increase in greenhouse gases per gallon. If it's stuff that is buried more deeply that has to be taken out, you know, we're talking about 50% increase in CO2. These are really significant numbers. So anyway, climate change, greenhouse gases is a big issue here. And transportation is about a third, in the U.S., about 30% of all the greenhouse gases come from transportation, and it's an increasing share. So the point is, greenhouse gas and oil trends for transportation are headed in the wrong direction. You know, we talked about, as I mentioned before, larger, bigger, more powerful vehicles, more travel, and now I've added on this idea of more carbon-intensive gasoline and diesel fuel. And this is the path we're headed on, you know, and there's no evidence these trends are going to change. You know, we can have hopeful, wishful curves that, you know, take these downward turns, but there's nothing right now that suggests that is going to happen. And so, so as we talk about these future options, you know, this is just a graph. You know, there are a lot of alternative fuel options. I've actually studied, you know, I did my PhD dissertation on transportation on alternative fuels back in 1980 or so, 82. And, you know, it's basically my whole career has been devoted to failures because 98% of all of our
transportation is on petroleum, is using petroleum. And the only real alternative fuel we have is ethanol made from corn, and that's not a very, that's not one of the good alternative fuels. So, there are a lot of choices, but it's been, you know, it's kind of this monoculture idea again. You know, it's really hard. You know, we've got, as you know, Jeffrey just said, you know, we've got this huge inertia. We've got this huge investment in pipelines and refineries and so on and so forth. And, you know, there's institutional and behavioral conservatism. And so we're not, it's hard to change. So the big options, I mentioned this very quickly in response to a question earlier, but as we think of the long term for transportation, there's basically three major sets of options. One is biomass, cellulosic ethanol, taking trees and grasses and the cellulosic material there and converting them into ethanol, or actually could be methanol as well. There's some potential for this in the United States. We have a lot of land. We grow a lot of material. There's potential in some other places like Brazil. But it's probably worldwide, it's pretty limited. You know, there's not going to be much of that in China, not in Europe, not in Japan. And so, you know, there's potential, but it's probably not going to be a dominant energy source, even in the U.S. We have the electric vehicles. We have the battery electrics, and I, you know, add in the plug-in hybrids. And there we've got something that can really, can be a substantial part of the future. The batteries are probably, you know, we don't see any way that batteries are going to actually make it possible to have a type of vehicle we have now, you know, that can go 500 miles and at high performance and so on in a big SUV, but it can be in more limited vehicles, limited applications. And then we come up with hydrogen. And so, you know, I've done a lot of work on hydrogen. Actually, I'm doing a commercial too. My last book on hydrogen. So if you're interested, I got flyers for it. See, we learn from our business partners, you know. We're in academia. We're not totally naive. So, you know, the third, come down to hydrogen, you know, and I, you know, the first two are, have some promise, but probably don't look like they're a good dominant option that really can be the major energy source, not for the U.S. and definitely not in most other places. So it's kind of like I end up, you know, with hydrogen, you know, there's got a lot of problems with it, it's a lot of difficulties, but I end up thinking, if not hydrogen, then what? You know, if we're really talking serious, it's hard to imagine a transportation future, you know, without hydrogen being a major part of it, is where I come down. So the hydrogen, you know, there's potentially large benefits. But there are a lot of challenges. You know, we've talked a little about it, and in the Q&A we can talk some more about it. You know, one way of thinking about it is this means transforming the two largest industries in the world, you know, the oil industry and the automobile industry. You don't do that easily or lightly or quickly. And this is just another characterization. One of the attractions of hydrogen is you can make it almost from almost anything. And it can be used for a lot of different sources. An important way of thinking about this is in terms of life cycle emissions. And so this looks at, you know, like cradle to grave, you know, well to wheel, and compares different options. And, you know, gasoline being, you know, in this case, 400 grams per mile. The hybrid vehicle, you know, gives you about a 30, you know, it's about one-third less at best. Electric vehicles, depending on where the electricity comes from, is about the same, maybe a little better. In California, by the way, electric vehicles are very attractive because we have a very clean electricity system, a very low-carbon electricity system, so it would be much better than that. And then hydrogen, you know, if you made it from natural gas, is a little better than that. If you made it from renewables, it's much, much better. But there are bad, you know, there are, you know, ways that aren't so good. Do it through electrolysis, where if you have dirty electricity or, you know, electricity made from coal, and then use that to split the water, then, you know, you're using up a lot of energy. You're not really gaining anything, at least in the near term. And one of the things to be thinking about is transitions. How do we get from here to there? And, you know, sometimes you have to do something in the near term which gets you to the long term. And so one of the ways of thinking about it is market pathways with fuel cells. You know, cars are one of the hardest markets to crack for a fuel cell because, you need a technology that's cheap and you need to, it has to be very flexible, used in a lot of different ways. And so we need to think about other ways of getting there. So this is kind of a pathway down. There's other higher value uses of fuel cells and hydrogen, but getting there, again, is not straightforward, but it's a way of thinking about it. And another way of thinking about it is in terms of a technology pathway, because, a fuel cell is an electric vehicle. It uses some of the technology developed for the battery electrics, which were then applied to the hybrid electrics and now being applied to the fuel cell. The Toyota fuel cell vehicle, we have two of them at UC Davis that we run for Toyota, where we do market research and public outreach. And that, a lot of the technology there, it comes right out of their Prius. So we have a governor here that's very enthusiastic about hydrogen. There he is, smiling, and there I am smiling on the side. And just to keep it all in good humor. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. As Dan mentioned, one of the major things that needs to happen for us to move along this path towards whatever the future is going to be, hydrogen or any other fuel, is a major shift in two major industries. And we're fortunate to have with us today someone who spends most of his time advising one of the major California companies, or California-based company, Chevron Texaco, on just these issues. Arthur Lee I have to get his exact title. I don't want to get this wrong. Arthur Lee is the principal advisor on global policy and strategy in corporate health and environmental safety for Chevron Texaco. And he works on issues for Chevron Texaco involving internal energy policy, air pollution issues, as well as actions addressing climate change concerns. Also within the industry more broadly, he's currently the leader of the policy and incentives team of the Carbon Dioxide Capture Project, which is the global joint industry governments project to develop the next generation of carbon dioxide capture and storage technology. Prior to joining Texaco, Arthur Lee was a regulator with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, where he focused on acid rain, and also he held positions at Fluor Daniel as a chemical process engineer. He has a master's degree in chemical engineering from the California Institute of Technology and a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which helped him win that chocolate, that Swiss chocolate. And he's going to talk to us today about infrastructure, which is obviously a major challenge, processing and distribution changes needed to make alternative fuels available to the public. Please welcome Arthur Lee.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Larry. You heard a lot about energy and thermodynamics here today. So anything I slip up on in thermodynamics, I can only blame a little bit of myself and Jeff Tester, who taught me that advanced thermo. So anyway, just a little bit of a change here. Chevron Texaco has changed its name to Chevron Corporation since May 9th. And so you see everything I should say here is all Chevron Corporation. And what we're trying to do in terms of the whole issue on energy and climate change is to be able to do things that are that makes business sense to us, that will continue to manage carbon in a way that is cost effective and would allow us to be a good company as well as a good citizen. Now, the issue of climate change is very important to us, and I just want to be able to bring four key messages to you today. In that, in looking and managing at this issue of greenhouse gas and climate change, we have a very strong centralized management process and a team in place to do this. And we have the processes and tools that allow us to do this and integrate it into a very core of our businesses, into new projects and all of our big capital projects. We also have a carbon markets team, as we recognize that carbon does have a value. And so we do have a team in place to deal with that. And we certainly value all of our partnerships in technology development and with other stakeholders around the world. I will say one other thing, that Chevron is a global company. We are based in California, based right here in the Bay Area. We operate in or have businesses in approximately 180 countries with 47,000 employees. So that's the breadth and scope of our company at this time. And this issue is very important to us and certainly important to our stakeholders and to our shareholders as well as to our employees. And the kind of importance that we attach to this goes back all the way back to the wellhead, as you can see here, the wellhead to our marketing terminals. I will say that we have published our corporate responsibility report for the last 2 years now, and we will soon publish another one in the summer, that the emission numbers for our operations, for all of our businesses, of what we own, is approximately 60 million metric tons. That's, give you a sense of scale, that's the scale of emissions from a small country like Singapore or Austria. So we do know where we are in terms of emissions, and we've also been acknowledging numbers such as end-use emissions, where we know that our customers, when they use our fuels, coal, oil, and gas, it produces approximately 370 million metric tons of CO2, which is about 1.7% of global emissions. And so that's a number we also acknowledge and we publish. So this issue is very important to us as a company, as a business, and to our employees and to our shareholders. Since day one of Chevron Texaco, when we merged in October 2001, we've had this policy statement, or what we call our fourfold action plan. It literally is based on many of the actions that I will show you today. One, we are reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and top of our list is increasing energy efficiency. You've already heard a lot about fuel efficiency and all that. I just want to impress upon you that we as a company, operationally, we want to be as efficient as possible for many reasons. We also are investing in research and development and improving our technology, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. In fact, I'll talk about more about that and also about number three, pursuing business opportunities in promising innovative energy technologies. A lot more in two and three, and touch a little bit on four. On this issue alone, we have over 20 to 30 folks across the company, usually at a director or a general manager's level, in this council that manages this issue. I won't go into any details, but there are a lot of functions that we look at in terms of just looking at our emissions inventory. How we even come up with a number, it has to be a very rigorous process so that we know when we report to the public that we have a good number. We have a team on looking at even capital projects, because as a big company, we are looking at projects that are going to be around with us for a long time, and those projects need to consider greenhouse gas emissions for the life of that project. And we have teams on technology and other things as well, which I'll go into. So this very centralized approach to our decentralized company, bringing together about those approximately 20 people across the company from all sorts of business segments and also in our technology companies, we have been able to, since 1992, when we first adopted the Chevron Energy Index, we have improved by energy efficiency by 24%. I can report to you today that our number is, for 2004, is down to 76%, 76 in our index. And in terms of emissions, the rigorous numbers that I talked about in getting a worldwide emission inventory done since 2002, we have kept the emissions relatively flat. It's basically about 60 all across, about 62 or so, and now that back down to 62. So our emissions have been fairly flat over the last 3 years. And we will continue to improve our energy efficiency as well as trying to reduce many of our emissions in terms of flaring and venting of gases. I won't say too much about this, but those of you in the accounting fields might know that counting numbers is actually not that easy, especially when it comes to financial accounting. But even in emissions accounting, this is a new field, and we have even 3 years ago when I, 3 or 4 years ago when we started doing this worldwide for Chevron and Texaco, there were no standards and guidelines have to be written and industry have to agree to them. And we certainly led this effort to develop industry-wide guidelines and also the tools, necessary tools to do that. And the Sangea tool is the result of that, which we actually donated to the rest of industry. We didn't charge anybody anything. And so that we can push the standard so that all of industry would count apples to apples the same way. And we continue, we'll continue to look at the inventory issues and improve upon those numbers as an industry. We certainly have that expertise as well, leading certain industry groups and also now being involved in this intergovernmental panel on climate change. This panel of experts of experts from about 180 countries, that's part of the scientific panel of experts on climate change. And so we have that expertise in looking at global inventories and also leading some of the industry groups in the U.S. as well as elsewhere. I've touched upon this very briefly. Don't mind too much about this, the details here. But the point of this is, as Chevron, we basically have our new businesses in terms of our new projects that are multi-billion dollar projects, projects that have project life of 30 to 40 years. And so that also means emissions of 30 to 40 years. And so we realized very early on, even before the merger, both companies have already started looking at greenhouse gas issues for new projects. And after the merger, a set of tools were rolled out in 2003 to make the process much more rigorous and certainly required for all of the capital projects. These billion-dollar projects, and there are many of them, have to go through this process of looking at the kind of emission impact that they would have and also do document and also decide upon the kind of alternatives in design that would minimize emissions. I've shown you a little bit about inventory, about our energy efficiency efforts and the results. And so, that's really building upon our foundation. And we have tools, thank you. We have tools that allow us to continue to make these efficient energy projects as well as low, as well as keeping our emissions managed. And we are setting out on a long-term emission strategy, many of us in our company. Strategic planning across the enterprise are looking at a much more robust, even more robust strategy to deal with this, the long-term issues of emissions. There are many signposts. I don't have to go over many of these for you. I think some of you in the audience read a lot in the press. Kyoto Protocol certainly is here with us today, and we know that certain U.S. states, including the state we live in, are continuing the plans on regional greenhouse gas management. And certainly Canada, our neighbor to the north, is continuing its policy development. It has ratified a protocol. We have businesses there. We operate there in a significant way. And certainly we are watching all of the developments to be sure that we are in compliance. We realize that carbon has value today. And those of you who follow this issue in the EU, the EU emission trading scheme is now operating since January. There is a value now. Carbon is trading around 18 to 19 euros, even at one point last week. So it does cost money to have emissions now in the EU. And certainly we have a team now. We have a centralized team, and we just hired a manager to lead this team, to carry out three key business functions for us in terms of policy and planning, a credits management function, which includes a registry, and also a function on project consulting and advocacy. In terms of project consulting, to be able to help these multi-billion dollar capital projects that we have to be able to look at carbon, to have value, and to be able to look at credits. There are many actions that I can go over today. I guess with the interest of time, I would just highlight a few. We certainly are very active with the MIT in several programs in the carbon sequestration. This has to do with Carbon sequestration has to do with a broad term for a set of technologies, including capturing CO2 from industrial gases, from power plants, and putting it, in our case, we in terms of geologic formation, putting CO2 back down into geologic formations safely and cost effectively. So this is one of the things that we're looking at and certainly working out with, work cooperatively with the MIT program. And there's also a key program that we're involved in that was first started by the World Bank, Global Gas Flaring Reduction Partnership. We were one of the first members to join, one of the first oil companies to join. And we're very active on the steering committee there. And we provide seconded personnel to that effort to be able to allow the company, the industry, to look at a sensible way of reducing flaring emissions. I'll just touch upon a few things, start showing you some photographs of things that we're actually doing. Right here in San Francisco, we are working, our Chevron Energy Solutions company. Remember what I said about energy efficiency. Not only are we ourselves trying to be as energy efficient as possible, we're trying to help our customers as well. Chevron Energy Solutions is a company that actually goes out and help many of our clients to audit their energy consumption and then help them reduce that energy consumption or find alternative energy supply. And in this case, right here in San Francisco, the largest mail distribution center here, we're working with them on renewable energy as well as changing out their lighting and doing other things to make the process much more efficient for the U.S. Postal Service. So we're doing this not only in San Francisco, but in many postal facilities in Northern California. And right across the bay in Richmond, we have a library here, a solar panel having been installed already, and we're working with other schools that actually help them save taxpayers money as well as installing renewable energy supply like solar panels. So it's a good business for us, and it's if it were a standalone company, Chevron Energy Solutions would be a fairly profitable company. Gas, we talk a lot about gas distinguished experts talk about a lot about petroleum and something about gas. We certainly have a global gas company that is looking at all across the value chain, from all the way from the wellhead again to downstream to power, and we have that capacity and the financial capacity as well as the engineering expertise to be able to bring more gas to the United States, as well as in our much more interdependent world on energy, to be able to supply gas around the world from different parts of the world. And I'll just show you a couple of projects of the many that we're planning and also are executing already. Nigeria, we have a large offshore natural gas pipeline that will not only help reduce flaring and venting in Nigeria, but bring that gas to the three countries downstream to be able to help them develop economically as well by having that gas be used for power generation to help them electrify their country. In Australia, we have, and I should have said that in West Africa too, that gas, some of that gas could also end up in the east coast of the United States as well. Australia too, we have a large gas development project. That resource there is over 40 trillion cubic feet of in the Greater Gorgon area. That's one of the largest gas fields in the world, and we certainly are the operator and a major presence there. And we will bring that gas to Asia or to North America. So that's a major project for us. But what's unique about this project is that even back in 2001, we have already, in a very groundbreaking way, already signed an agreement with the Australian federal government that we would commit to reducing emissions, the greenhouse gas emission from that project. And one of the ways that we are going to do that is to capture all of the CO2 that's coming from the natural gas field. Many of you would notice that natural gas actually comes in, depending on where it is geologically in the world, there can be a lot of CO2 or very little. In this case, there is some CO2 from our field, and we are going to reinject that CO2. And when we do, it will be one of the largest project in terms of CO2 reinjection, geologic storage. So with that, let me just quickly touch on other things, because Jeff Tester would probably say I didn't cover it, is that geothermal, and Jeff is an expert on geothermal, in Indonesia we are expanding our geothermal project. We already have over 100 megawatts in Indonesia, and we're going to expand it by over another 100 megawatts in Indonesia on geothermal power. And that geothermal power basically is coming from a volcano. So let's see. We have a whole operating company called Chevron Technology Ventures. I won't go into too many details about some of them, but the hydrogen business unit is certainly looking at the hydrogen economy and how we are going to help contribute to that. There's a company that deals in wind and solar and also battery technology and battery for hybrid electric vehicles. I won't say too much about this at all. Molecular diamonds is some structures of carbon that we're finding in our crude oil, which is very interesting to many of our researchers, that could be used for different kinds of storage or other applications. It's very interesting, but not being an expert, I won't say too much. Venture capital, we actually do have a venture capital arm, just like any of the Silicon Valley venture capital firm here, to invest in research that would augment our own capabilities in-house. Be very quick, just show some pretty photographs of our own right here in the San Joaquin Valley. We have one of the largest, if not the largest, solar facility in California. That's a Chevron facility, 500 kilowatt facility. And in Netherlands, we have in our joint project with another company, we have about 22.5 megawatt wind farm. We have, and in the future, when you buy your Priuses and other vehicles, we certainly hope to be the supplier of that battery under the hood. We already have a facility manufacturing those batteries that are going into fleets. So Chevron intends to be a major player in the hybrid electric vehicle market. Hydrogen. I can't get away without saying something about hydrogen. Certainly hydrogen, our hydrogen business unit has a vision, and we've done a lot of scenario planning exercises. And one of the visions that we do have is a distributed economic hydrogen-based transport system. And we are working towards that, helping U.S. government in this case. Dan Sperling knows this. UC Davis is a partner with us. We are the consortium leader and was awarded this DOE award almost a couple of years ago now to build all these things, the H2 fueling station and also fuel cell vehicles and all of that. Let me just show you pictures right away. This fuel cell right here sits right outside my office. It's been powering our computers in the Chevron headquarters for the last 3 years continually with very relatively few problems. So we're learning a lot from that operation. We're helping with the Alameda County Transit project, putting in a fleet of buses with fuel cells. This was a concept picture just before February for hydrogen station. Remember what we said about Governor Schwarzenegger? This is reality now. We opened up the hydrogen fueling station in Chino, California, and on that same day in 18th February, we also broke grounds in Florida for a second one, and we intend to build more. So that's a very quick wrap up here. Strong centralized management on the greenhouse issue because it is important to us. We have the tools to do it, we have the people to do it, and we certainly value many of the key partnerships that we have around the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Arthur, and certainly without the help of the industry that is looking forward to new forms, cleaner forms of energy and fuel for transportation, we're not going to be able to get there. We're just going to very briefly ask Philip Dietrich to come back up and give us just a few minutes on the European perspective on the path to alternative fuels issue, and then we will have time for just a couple of questions, and appreciate everyone's patience in staying. We're going to try to wrap it up as quickly as we can after this. And while we're doing that, I'll have another question for the audience. Who can tell me what
percentage of people with car sharing in the United States have sold one or more cars in their house after reduced by one or more the cars in their household because of car sharing, after joining car sharing. And there's Swiss chocolate on the line, so I'll take the first guess right there.
You just hit
80%. Page I wish it were 80%. No. Next guess. It's lower than 80%. That's close. 45. It's a little lower than that. 35. There you go. Okay. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
Here we go.
Thank you. We're going to talk back to hydrogen, and we have already seen that hydrogen is an energy carrier. So we still have to look that we have to produce hydrogen, and we have more or less chemical processes, electricity, and from the electricity you have to bring it back to about electrolysis to hydrogen. We are going to talk some ways we think it's possible on a renewable basis, and so we have to look that we can have a CO2 free or equal chain. So we have to use renewable energies, nuclear, fossil, together with sequestration. That are more or less the options we really have. Biomass is a feedstock for process industry, and we heard, at least in Europe, you know, the structure also from Europe is that this is can be used in some term on a limited basis, but I think it's more that we will use it as a feedstock than an energy carrier. One point is that we can use hydrogen to mixing fossil fuels, and the advantage from that is that if we can use today's fuels, we can have directly an impact on our today's cars. For example, if we can add additional renewable energy to today's fuel, we have on all cars which can use that fuel, for example, 5% change, because to turn over the whole fleet of cars needs about 10 to 15 years. So we have always to think in quite long-term processes. Then we have to look. If you start today, we see about the amount of CO2 which is released by the consumers from Chevron, which is about 1.5% of the global energy consumption, is today released or used as hydrogen. So it's not nothing. We are starting already as hydrogen, as a commodity, which is used in about 1.5% of the total energy consumption from the world. Only about 99% is based on fossil fuels. How could be or can be hydrogen transferred? And we see at the beginning, if we take it as bottle or in trucks, that's maybe a possibility. Liquefied, so there is quite a large of energy to produce that. We can ship it also liquid, and there is already existing quite a long network of hydrogen pipelines. That's, for example, within Europe, within Germany, a network which is about 400 kilometers, which is daily in use for some years. Totally in Europe exists about 1,000 kilometers of hydrogen pipeline network already now. How we can produce hydrogen now? We can make it by reforming, for example, from hydrocarbons and water, reforming with heat to hydrogen and CO2. That's possible, in principle, from biomass. But as you see, if we steaming up biomass with steam and heat, you get quite a different variety of components, and we see that we use at the end much more efficient methane and use, for example, in part of the hydrogen to create further methane than hydrogen on that route. But we also can use the heat by the sun or, for example, from nuclear to transform water to hydrogen and oxygen. When you start on the heat on the nuclear cycle, that are cycles which are now under discussion for fourth generation nuclear power plants, which could be ready in about 20 to 30 years. Here is the advantage: you can use electricity and the heat in the same time, but to do that we still need materials which are reliable also at high temperature. If you take the other way to use the solar energy, we are looking on using the heat to reduce zinc oxide, for example, to store here the energy. And in a second process, we can add water to the zinc to oxidize and release hydrogen. The charm from that process is that we can achieve today already 29% efficiency, which means we can get here in a rather interesting range of cost also for the hydrogen. Such a project now is, this is a test facility at the PowerShare Institute on a basis of about 50 kilowatts. We are testing now already in the range of half a megawatt the test facility in Israel, which delivers values in the range of that. So that could be one possibility for using the energy, solar energy, to produce hydrogen. That hydrogen is already produced quite industrially. We can learn, for example, a project which was made in the Aswan in Egypt, where this is an industrial electrolyzer today at work. And we have seen that after the release or the building of the dam of Aswan, there was quite a lot of electricity available. And as soon as you have electricity available at the place where you don't have other much consumers and perhaps also off-peak, then you can create a market where hydrogen production can be interesting. If you are looking, what are the prices? If you are looking today, we see we can produce hydrogen on different sources today, but still without CO2 sequestration. So we see the range is about 10 to 25 euro cents per kilowatt hours, but you see it's mainly based on fossil fuel, electricity if it's based in your mix, and as soon as you get to cleaner energies, it starts to rise quite dramatically. If you look down about the road about 15 years, we think that in the broad band, about 5 to 15 euro cents per kilowatt hours, there are also possibilities which are based on wind, solar thermal, or biomass, which are possibilities to produce hydrogen in that price range. What means that? I have took here a short graph on the curb weight of vehicles, and here is the consumption in kilowatt hours per 100 kilometers of all cars which are immatriculated in Switzerland. And you see the blue ones are gasoline, the black ones are diesel cars, and you see this one over here are Ferraris, so you see that. And the red dots are experimental cars and fuel cells we have produced in Switzerland at PSI. You see there's quite a big variety on fuel consumption. Today, with tax, we see most cars or the fuel that they spend per 100 kilometer ranges from 5 to 15 euro per 100 kilometer. And if you go to these 15 euro cents per kilowatt hours, you see we could spend so much hydrogen to get at the same price. And you see, due to the efficiency, we are below that, meaning that counted for the cost of fuel per 100 kilometer for the consumer, it rests more or less the same because we have higher efficiency. So higher prices per liter hydrogen or kilowatt hydrogen don't mean necessarily more cost for the consumer for the amount of distance he has driven. So, but to look at the mobility, I think we have to look, that is, it's the combination of traffic and infrastructure. And it's really necessary to look at the all items to look forward, because I think it's so a complex problem that we don't have one single bottom to look at. If you look at the assessment, I have to say we don't have to forget batteries. And at the moment, there is not a big eye or a golden bullet in view. But if you achieve at batteries at about 500 watt-hours per kilogram, that'd be possible. Batteries or electricity could be another option for transportation. All these things are made by quite a lot of colleagues contributed, and I would close with a Chinese proverb which said, we have really to look into the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Philip. It is a couple minutes past five, and I want to respect people who have appointments who need to go. But if others want to stay, if you could quietly leave, and we'll spend just no more than 10 minutes on Q&A for our second panel. So, again, for those who need to leave, please go ahead and do that quietly. Let me take a question right here, this gentleman.
Given all the problems... changing your efficiency and all that. What about sequestering carbon? In other words, looking at putting it away permanently. I read there's an experiment about seeding the oceans with iron, and the algae bloom sucks up a lot of carbon and you drive it into the continental trenches and all that. Is there anything practical on that front?
Sure. Let me ask the panel to come up and take just sit behind the table here.
So the question, did everybody hear the question? Because I'm going to have a hard time repeating it. Sequestration of carbon and different strategies for biological processes to soak up carbon, I think something like that.
Any one of us can take it.
Okay. Well, there we go. Jeff, you're up.
What is there are many options out there, obviously, for carbon sequestration, but they come at some cost. For one thing, there's an energy cost of capturing the carbon. Envisioning this, trying to do it with stationary sources is hard enough, electric plants. But to try to figure out how we might do this with a mobile system using the fuels we have is really not very tenable. So we'd have to switch the fuel type. If we went to hydrogen, sequestered the carbon at the site where we're making the hydrogen, that would be possible. You saw the example that Philip gave where we were reforming hydrocarbon fuels, the carbon dioxide and hydrogen, using water, steam reforming type processes that are in existence today. But we have to sequester the carbon at some energy cost, for sure, to capture. The other big uncertainty of this is that we can't just sequester this for a short period of time. It has to be sequestered for a long period of time. If we look back to Professor Sperling's graph, we're talking about a century or more scale of capture and sequestration to achieve the kind of CO2 stabilization that we need. And so that will be a daunting task to ensure that these reservoirs, in fact, do hold this carbon dioxide. The ocean has been discussed, and the deep ocean that has other issues with it. Biological storage has some short-term impacts that could be very positive. Reforestation of deforested lands and things. But to do it on the scale that really makes a dent, I think, on the carbon issues that we saw in these graphs, we're going to have to get serious about it. It would have to be at a scale that tackles the transportation and electricity generation system. So it would be much more aggressive than just storing it in biomass.
Anyone else in the panel want to add to that? That's quite a thorough...
I don't know. It's a tough question.
Okay. Let's take a question on this side.
Okay. I just wanted to ask Mr. Lee about the thing you put from Chevron Corporation for biofuels, ethanol, and greater than additive.
Short answer is yes. We're looking at, we have a technology arm of our company that's been looking at that technology and various aspects of that technology very closely. Beyond that, I can't get into details. Part of it is because I'm not an expert in that area, but we all.
Question right here.
Yes, Russell Long, Blue Earth Network, Friends of the Earth, and the question I had to do with a slide I saw 2 years ago from the National Renewable Energy Lab. I think, Jared, you might want to address this. Feel free to email Stan or others. The slide showed when we could power all of our needs, the entire U.S. grid, as well as all of the automobiles, light duty, that are being used in the U.S., simply by having, I say simply, wind energy and solar creating hydrogen, using significant areas within the states of North and South Dakota, Nevada, and Texas. Now, they didn't put any cost figures on that. I mean, obviously, that's one of the big problems. I find it very hard to believe that the costs themselves wouldn't be commensurate with some of the costs we're spending in Iraq. So
basically, is that viable?
Okay. Jeff, let me let you.
Familiar with the graphs that you're referring to, and they have to do with this what I'll call sort of a one-dimensional solution approach. If we did all this in the high insulation where we have a lot of solar energy, maybe it's Nevada, Arizona, we could generate all the electric power. We could go to North Dakota, but keep in mind with wind. Keep in mind that we need to be able to distribute this, okay? And we can generate the electricity. But we have to go to address that infrastructure issue that I had on the slide there. So it isn't just the cost of converting the electric generation system, which may be acceptable. We also have to create the transmission and distribution system and storage system. We would have to dynamically store this hydrogen somewhere that we're going to make, or electricity if we went to electric vehicles. So I feel that it's more, sort of a portfolio management. If you set your destination as we want to reduce our dependence on imported oil or whatever it might be by X amount, then there are many ways you can do this. And wind would be certainly one you'd have to look at more seriously than we are now. Biofuels, I think, would be another way. Even carbon sequestration should be out there with respect to coal and things like that. But we'd have to, I think, rethink nuclear power and other things too. So it is a legitimate number. I think if you want to look at, is the resource big enough to do the sort of thing you're saying? Yes, it is big enough, but it needs more things than just the generation of the power.
Right. If you added the cost of the infrastructure and transmission lines for the hydrogen or other means to move the hydrogen, is there any sense of what that infrastructure plus the power itself would cost to generate?
Sure. Yeah, there are numbers there for that, and they are big, and I think they involve a transformation from where we are now, because you have to think of this. Let's give the example of what's going on in my own state right now with the Cape Wind project, which is trying to put up 400 megawatts or so of wind power. It'll be the largest offshore project anywhere on the earth right now. And even in a site like that that has a high wind resource grade, it's many miles offshore, so it's not just sitting on land where the siting issues, I think, are particularly troubling to some. That project is seriously being delayed by a few sort of NIMBY people that feel that they don't want to have that in Nantucket Sound. So I think this is the case where if you're willing to take the trade-off of a siting of another type of plant, whether it's windmills that has a visual issue or solar panels which would have the same thing, then I think the cost would be acceptable for electricity. But for transportation fuels, I think that's another step up that we haven't really maybe gotten aggressive enough about. If we're going to make liquid fuels in the existing system, that's one thing. But to make gaseous hydrogen, I think it's much more ambitious, let's say.
I'll just add very briefly that until 1986, in the early 80s, there was a pretty robust industry in California that was getting going on wind in particular, but other forms of renewable energy. And then the federal tax laws changed dramatically in 1986. And one of the effects, unintended, one might argue, was that
that industry more or less shut down for 20 years, and it's just now coming back. So we have time for about two more questions right here in the front.
I would be interested if you have anything to say about economic constraints, whether it be regressive taxes or subsidies that there will be, I guess, inhibitors to change in the fuels that we have, and also on a separate note, what we might do to get progress in that area.
Okay, thank you. So economic policies, tax policies, it sounds like that may,
I'm going to ask Dan to take a stab at that. It sounds like a U.S. policy.
Well, I think it's, you're probably implying that we're subsidizing oil and gas and coal, I suspect is where we're.
Yes, we are.
We are, but,
and the more that we're fighting for that oil.
That's okay. The Iraq thing is certainly a situation, but in terms of direct subsidies to the industry, it's pretty small compared to the scale that would be needed to get some of these fuels started. Ethanol from corn, for instance, gets 53 cents a gallon subsidy, federal plus a lot of states add more into that. And so that's kind of the scale that's being used to bring in a fuel that's pretty, a liquid fuel, pretty similar to compete with gasoline in a sense. So to bring in, I think we're talking about tax breaks to get things started. The barriers to change are so great. And when you start up whether you start up hydrogen, when you're starting up where you need to get up to scale economies fairly quickly or else it's very expensive, or you have a very distributed system, which tends to be expensive when you start, the costs are just very high. And so it's the reason we don't have alternative fuels. And I think it's kind of like what Jeff was saying, is we have to figure out what's important. And if it is important not to be fighting wars in the Middle East, for instance, that we want to come up with alternatives to petroleum, we need to come up with a strategy. We don't have a strategy. And, my own personal bias in this is that, like, a hydrogen future and even something like electricity futures need a tremendous amount of R&D. Because we've basically let a lot of the energy R&D atrophy, along with the tax breaks, we've let the R&D atrophy. So, I served on one national academy panel looking at hydrogen in particular, and over again, senior industrial R&D people said, we can and we should be going to solar hydrogen and renewable hydrogen, and we can do it, but it's going to require a huge investment. We don't know exactly how to get there, but we as a society have to decide that we want to do it. And partly that's industry making the commitment, but it's also on the public side giving the incentives and tax breaks, as well as the basic R&D to get there. And we're not doing that.
Thank you. I still want to ask you.
I can add here a little bit side view of Europe. Where you see, we are dealing with the gasoline price between $5 to $6 a gallon, and you see, we have seen the figures. Cars, the average of driven is in the range of $35 to $40 per gallon. So there is a link between the policies you have, very intense, you have taxes or incentives. Another point where you can see, for example, in Germany, there is an incentive, for example, for wind power that we can get or substitute or bring back to the grid the wind power generated for a certain amount of money. And so if that is guaranteed, you see, there is a business and this instrument to see how the price for generating wind power was coming down, also in economy of scale. And therefore, I think there is really an issue that political boundary conditions are set
and can be influence at least the structure of the energy system and also at the end the consumer. According to and the consumer sees an advantage to go there, he will go there.
Okay, we have time for one final question. That's one right here.
I was just wondering, let's say that in 2020, what percentage of the energy that you provide do you believe will be from renewable sources?
I wouldn't have any numbers for Chevron, I think, if you project it. But certainly there are lots of numbers that I think professors from, and also Professor Tester have alluded to already, that percentage, and according to the International Energy Agency, that percentage is still in the, I think, in the 2s and 3%, as far as I can remember. And it's a number that you can actually look up yourself. You can look up yourself and check that's right.
And just to put that in context, I think that in
California today, we're already above 5%. Statewide certainly for electricity production, I believe that's the case. So
California is a real leader for the nation and has been
from the beginning.
We will do our best with the leadership here. I want to thank our panelists. Thank you all for coming, and again, thank the Paul Scherrer Institute, the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, MIT, UC Davis, and Chevron Texaco. And I have to make one final pitch for Jeff Tester's book, Sustainable Energy, it's coming out, and also for Dan Sperling's book, The Hydrogen Energy Transition, already out right here. Thank you all.